Welcome to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from September 16th, 1999.
From the high desert and the great American Southwest, I bid you all good evening or good morning, as the case may be, across this great land of ours, nearly now, finally, bereft of hurricanes upon it, as it just moves on north. Goodbye and good riddance, Floyd. Welcome from the Tahitian and Hawaiian Islands in the west, eastward to the Caribbean and the U.S. Virgin Islands, south all the way into South America, north to the pole, and worldwide on the internet, thanks to our friends at broadcast.com who distribute far and wide, so somebody in India can listen to us, or England, or Japan, or anywhere around the world. And of course, the brilliance of the Intel Corporation, which put together all the math that allowed this G2 program to come to fruition. Amazing G2, indeed amazing. G2 is something you can go to my website, www.artbell.com, and download, and then just install into your computer, and come back to my website, and click on streaming video, and voila, there it is. Here I am. You can both see and hear me in what I call almost TV. It's really cool. And by the way, our SETI team, Team Art Bell, is now and has been for some number of days number one in the nation, racing by all the other teams up there. So if you want to be part of the biggest SETI at home team in the United States, you will go to my website, download the SETI at home program, which is cool beyond description, incidentally, and join Team Art Bell. Because, you know, we might find it. We might be the ones to find the signal.
Looking for the truth? You'll find it on Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
I really believe that my role is to inform people, to try to bring them the truth. Yes, this is a program where we have some fun, and sometimes it's very, very unusual and strange. But I want them to understand what's happening in the world around them, whether it's climate change, economy, war, and the reasons for all these things. So that's what I think my mission is.
Streamlink, the audio subscription service of Coast to Coast AM, has a new name, Coast Insider. You'll still get all the same great features for the same low price, just 15 cents a day when you sign up for 1 year. The package includes podcasting, which offers the convenience of having shows downloaded automatically to your computer or MP3 player, and the iPhone app with live and on-demand programs. You'll also get our amazing download library of 3 full years of shows. Just think. As a new subscriber, over 1,000 shows will be available for you to collect, enjoy, and listen to at your leisure. Plus, you'll get streamed and on-demand broadcasts of Art Bell's Somewhere in Time shows and 2 weekly classics. And as a member, you'll have access to our monthly live chat sessions with George Norrie and special guests. If you're a fan of Coast, you won't want to be without Coast Insider. Visit coasttocoastam.com to sign up today. Stories on the radio must be Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
You know, when I started doing this radio program, Jesse, half of the subjects I was really into, the paranormal, the unusual, ghosts and things like that.
Yeah.
The conspiracy stories, you know, I was a little weary about these, other than the Kennedy assassination. And all of a sudden, I woke up. I simply woke up. Is that what happened with you too?
Yeah, that's when I really started to say, what is going on here? And I started to truly then investigate 9/11. And today, I don't believe the government story of 9/11. Here's the 3 options. Either we knew about it and allowed it to happen, or we knew about it and participated in it, or these were the dumbest buffoons that could have ever been in charge of our country, who could have all this pre-information. And I started to think they knew it was going to happen. They either are part of it or they allowed it to. There's no doubt in my mind.
Now we take you back to the night of September 16th, 1999, on Art Bell, Somewhere in Time.
Mm-hmm.
lonely by himself with his telephone bank, and reports flowing in, and as a matter of fact, actually gushing in recently, is Peter Davenport at the National UFO Reporting Center in Seattle, Washington. And you may recall last week, it's like the sky was falling. And so we're going to do sort of an update for you on all of that. And additionally, we are going to present some new material tonight. Peter, welcome to the program.
As always, thank you, Art. It's nice to be here tonight.
Great to have you.
I think that assessment is a fair one. I've never seen quite this volume of UFO material in the 5 years that I've been doing this. And as I mentioned in my facts to you tonight, I've been handling actually three major cases for the last roughly 1 month. The flash over New Mexico, I have a little bit of new information about that.
Okay.
The event that occurred over Oregon and California, Nevada and Utah, perhaps other states as well, on the 1st of September, and I've got a great deal of new information about that.
Oh, good.
And the incident that, of course, occurred over Florida last week may in some way be related to what happened over the Pacific Northwest, but that is only surmise. I've never seen anything like this, and that ignores all the fireballs and the various other, the triangles that have been reported to us in the last 2 weeks. I have a few audio cuts about those if we have time towards the end of the program.
Gah.
But the incident that I would like to focus on tonight is the one that occurred on the 1st of September. I have learned now, since my last appearance on Coast, I've learned a great deal more about that incident over Oregon on the 1st of September.
You missed my little humor, Peter. I said, duh.
Duh.
Duh. That's Russian.
Yes, I'm here, Gil.
I'm not going to get that into that with you at all.
But I ignored it.
All right, go.
I'd love to speak Russian with you.
Not a chance.
But let me give just a little prelude of what we've learned in the last week. First of all, when all of this started, I had no idea what the quality of the Oregon Air National Guard fighter interceptor group is. Apparently, it's the most outstanding group in the nation. And some of the initial reports that were fed to us suggested that this incident that occurred on the 1st of September was part of a training exercise. Well, two things about that. I think that exercise was called Sentry Eagle. And my understanding is they had some German aircraft in Portland to fly with the Oregon Air National Group. The Oregon group is so good that when foreign groups of fighter pilots come to this country, they are shunted to the Oregon Air National Guard for their training purposes.
Okay.
And they apparently had at least two groups of fighter pilots in town. One was a group of Germans flying Phantoms, F-4s, is my understanding. All of this is tentative information, but this is what I've learned. In addition, they had some Navy pilots in town with F-14s, and they did have a training exercise, but our understanding is that it was completed by the end of August sometime.
End of August,
and this incident that occurred on the 1st of September, I believe, probably had nothing to do with what happened had nothing to do with that training episode, let's call it.
Either that or they were training to break windows.
Yeah, that could be. What I'd like to do is start with a short audio clip. This comes from a federal law enforcement officer who is about 40 miles west of Salem, Oregon. Salem sits on I-5.
Right.
This gentleman was outside. He was on patrol, and he apparently was one of the first to see this object coming across the coast of Oregon, headed almost due east, he says, and it's very intriguing to hear how he describes the object and what the object did. Let me just go to the cut, and it'll give our listeners some idea of just how complex an object this was. Here we go.
All right.
Okay, on September 1st, 99, at about 9:30 p.m., I was on patrol around Institution, and in the south sky, about 25 degrees up, moving from west to east, was an object in the sky, probably at arm's length, about a half inch long.
Mm-hmm.
And it had a 45 degree angle to 50 degree angle nose up going through the atmosphere, and it was burning like something would. And after about 30 seconds of that, it got through the atmosphere, quit burning, it leveled off, It was glowing blue, heading east, and then it swept towards the southeast, and it accelerated. And if there's F-15s, I don't think they could have caught them.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to laugh, but I mean, that's so far off from anything that is space junk and or meteorites or anything else.
Clearly it is. The problem is we had only one report, and this gentleman holds a very responsible position. He had a very good look at this on a very clear night, but again, it was only one report. Let me, without delay, now go to what I consider to be one of the most interesting reports I've received to date. This is a young man. He is a farmer. He grows broccoli seed. George Bush would love him. Broccoli seed out near Florence, Oregon. And he was driving south that night at about 9:30 p.m. with his girlfriend. They were in the vicinity of Albany, Oregon, or Corvallis, Oregon, headed south. And this is about a two-minute cut in which he describes what he and his girlfriend witnessed, and they were just awestruck by this object. Wait until you hear how he describes it. All right. Here we go.
I was traveling from Portland going down to Eugene. I was just crossing, going south of Corvallis at the time, about 9:30 on the 1st of September. I'm very familiar and have been interested in the night skies all my life, pretty much. I've seen many meteors passing very closely in the atmosphere, as well as I've seen some interesting malfunctions in man-made aircraft. And I had never, ever, ever seen anything like this before. It was actually my girlfriend who first spotted it. It was about in the right corner of the front windshield, traveling from southwest going southeast. And it appeared like one of the biggest objects I've ever seen in the sky. What I could probably say looked almost like a skyscraper moving laterally. And at that point, I had seen nothing but fire. It was a huge, huge ball of fire, bigger than I'd ever seen, and looked hotter than maybe I'd ever even seen a fire. It traveled completely glowing in what looked like almost a half inch to an inch of diameter of a fireball in the sky, all the way across the sky until about midway in my windshield, and then it actually just poof, went out and continued to look like a skyscraper flying across the sky for almost the same amount of length I saw it travel to me. And it was amazing. It definitely was the largest object I'd ever seen of that nature, and it did continue to come in, and I'm sure it hit the ground somewhere. At the time, I said to my girl right away, I said, I don't know what that is, but that is the first thing I've ever seen that was active. That was 100% unidentifiable flying object. I've been all my life looking to the sky, waiting to see something. I've seen quite a few things that I couldn't describe, but I could also say that I could probably say it might have been something. This was something that I was 100% sure of from the beginning, that this was not anything that I'd ever seen, or that it was just obviously completely different.
Completely different. And that object was flying sideways in the atmosphere.
A skyscraper, he described it as.
A skyscraper. He said it was huge. It was unimaginably huge.
Reminds me of the conversion of the pastor last week.
Yeah, at 5:05 in the morning. That's right. And if I marshal my time carefully during this hour, we might talk about that case in Florida, because in point of fact, simultaneous to that sighting in Florida near Tampa Bay and Orlando, there was a major sighting occurring over the Midwestern United States at exactly the same instant.
Da-da.
And I may be able to play some tapes of what people saw over Norman, Oklahoma, headed southeast, and 7 minutes later it was over Memphis, Tennessee, and 2 minutes left after that, according to our data, it was over Lake Charles, Louisiana. But I'm only tempting our audience with that.
Well, I mean, trace that little path geographically in your mind.
That is a long distance to cover.
Well, yeah, but it's also, there's nothing symmetrical about it. It's a giant U-turn.
Yeah, and there were points in between. In Arkansas, we have a report from Tennessee. I'm still not sure whether it was just one object that went from Norman, Oklahoma to Lake Charles. We could have had two or three or more very strange objects. And in today's mail, we got an colored illustration from both gentlemen in Norman, Oklahoma, and in Memphis, Tennessee. I wish I could show them over the telephone here. Most incredible ship with windows and exhaust ports that I've ever seen in the 5 years that I've been doing this.
Windows, yep.
Yeah. But what I'd like to do, looks like we have a few more minutes here. I would like to go to a continuation of the report I got from this young gentleman, because his report is not over yet.
All right.
15 minutes later, this first sighting occurred at 21:30 hours, 9:30 on Wednesday, the 1st of September. But about 15 minutes later, as he and his girlfriend are going to the south, continuing south on I-5, they spot something hovering off to the west side of I-5 that just absolutely flabbergasted them. So they had not one, but two sightings of two separate, completely different objects. And here is his description of what they saw at 9:45 p.m.
All right.
15 minutes later, I'm not exactly sure if I was still heading the same direction or not, but also right into the sky, and I'm not sure if it was west or not, but right to me as I was facing it, I saw a huge, huge dome, which seemed as if it went almost up to the stars from my view from the ground. It was huge, about what would appear to be about six of the fullest moons that you've seen in mass, and it seemed as if the middle of the dome was not lit. It was only illuminated by the outer shell of the dome, and it was glowing extremely powerfully bright. It was like a maroonish red glow, almost what I could identify with almost a radioactive blast, although I've not seen one. It was stationary. It was one arcing maroonish red, very bright, hot. Very fast illumination.
Wow.
A dome. A purple-colored dome with what appeared to be sort of lightning bolts coming out of it. This thing was, according to this report, it was hovering beside I-5, not too far off the ground, probably within 500 or 1,000 feet, perhaps, of the ground. Very difficult to estimate accurately. But I talked to this gentleman just this morning. He called that Wednesday night when I was on coast live reporting some of the reports that were coming into us.
Yes.
And it was only just today that I finally unburdened myself of enough work to be able to get back to him.
Sure.
But it fills in some of the question marks we had, because we have multiple reports, I think now six reports, that have the F-15s going out of Portland International Airport at between 9:30 and 9:35. Now, that was exactly the time that the large object was going over Oregon or had gone over, because within minutes it was down over Florida.
All right. Well, look, Peter.
Down over California.
California. Look, Peter, I think this is an important point that we have to tackle with all of this. Number one, we were told it was a Russian space booster reentering. The reports that you have given us now over a large period of time absolutely tear that to pieces. Number two, they've told you that, yes, the planes were there and taking off, but that it was an exercise. Well, we now know, no, it wasn't. And moreover, these airplanes shattered windows with afterburners cooking as they left, chasing after this thing.
That's exactly correct.
So they have not told us the whole rest of the story, as Paul Harvey would say, have they?
I don't believe they have. And as I think I reported before, we were first told that a press release had been issued by the Oregon Air National Guard apprising the public of the upcoming night exercises. Well, I talked to a public affairs officer down there, and I said, well, where was it published? And she said, well, we have no control over who publishes these reports. We just hand them out and let them make that decision. Well, I said, well, to whom were they sent?
Okay.
And she wasn't clear on that point. And I said, well, when you send them to the Oregonian, for example, in Portland, the largest newspaper in the Pacific Northwest, where do you send it? Which office? To the news desk, to an editor, or what?
And?
At which point she said, well, actually, in this case, this was the one and only instance in which her office had not issued a press release about the upcoming exercise.
Well, now just imagine that.
Yep.
Imagine that.
So we took a great deal of heat 2 weeks ago over this issue. We were criticized for not having contacted NORAD and contacted official sources. Other people did that. They apparently got a story which satisfied them. But it appears to be fraying very, very rapidly at the edges, and it looks more and more like this was a major intercept, and it looks to me as though the Oregon Air National Guard has distinguished itself remarkably. And there are a few other issues about this that we can talk about after the break.
All right, good. Well, look, this story is not fraying at the edges. It's coming down like a ragged Russian booster.
Yep.
Stay right there, Peter. So there you have the rest of the story. This is Coast to Coast AM.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from September 16th, 1999. Listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from September 16th, 1999.
Anybody out there remember the name Billy Goodman? If you're from the West, this rough area, you should. It's, better than a decade ago, I think. Billy Goodman was at a radio station on the other side of town from me in Las Vegas. At a time I was interviewing John Lear, the son of Bill Lear, about UFOs, Billy was doing a similar show on the other side of town, and that was a good decade ago, and this was his theme song. Should jog a few memories out there.
Streamlink, the audio subscription service of Coast to Coast AM, has a new name, Coast Insider. You'll still get all the same great features for the same low price, just 15 cents a day when you sign up for 1 year. The package includes podcasting, which offers the convenience of having shows downloaded automatically to your computer or MP3 player, and the iPhone app with live and on-demand programs. You'll also get our amazing download library of 3 full years of shows. Just think. As a new subscriber, over 1,000 shows will be available for you to collect, enjoy, and listen to at your leisure. Plus, you'll get streamed and on-demand broadcasts of Art Bell's Somewhere in Time shows and 2 weekly classics. And as a member, you'll have access to our monthly live chat sessions with George Norrie and special guests. If you're a fan of Coast, you won't want to be without Coast Insider. Visit coasttocoastam.com to sign up today. Looking for the truth? You'll find it on Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
I really believe that my role is to inform people, to try to bring them the truth. yes, this is a program where we have some fun, and sometimes it's very, very unusual and strange. But I want them to understand what's happening in the world around them, whether it's climate change, economy, war, and the reasons for all these things. So that's what I think my mission is.
Now we take you back to the night of September 16th, 1999, on Art Bell, Somewhere in Time.
Once again, from Seattle, Washington, the National UFO Reporting Center's Peter Davenport. Peter, you're back on.
Thank you, Art. And I am pleased to be able to talk about this case. You know, one point you make frequently on your programs is one of the first victims of anything is the truth.
Always.
And that certainly seems to be the case in this instance. You know, I find it particularly annoying that the American public are the last ones to learn the truth about anything that our government does, it seems. Unless, of course, they want us to know what it is they're doing or allegedly doing. This appears to be the case. It's, I think, noteworthy to point out that NORAD released an official statement saying that the event that was caused over Oregon and California was due to a Russian missile.
Mm.
Well, we're pursuing that angle, and so far it looks as though the Russians disclaim any knowledge of this booster.
Yes, the story is just falling to pieces.
It is.
Yeah.
And it troubles me. As you know, I used to live in the Soviet Union, used to work there as a sort of a minor junior diplomat. We used to laugh at the pathetically veneer arguments that the Soviet government would throw at its own people.
Mm-hmm.
What really troubles me profoundly is that we're now seeing similar trends in this country. And this, of course, is a political statement. It's an editorial. But I think we have to be very careful as a free people to hold the government's feet to the fire when it comes to the truth. After all, a free people cannot, I feel, cannot vote intelligently unless they're getting accurate, meaningful, objective information that allows them to make a sound decision. And we now have, at least in this instance, and I think in many others, but talking about this instance tonight, I think we have government that is doing anything but feeding us accurate information, and we've got to be very careful about that, in my opinion. This is a classic case of a government that just doesn't want the information to get out there. And so they use officialdom, they use bureaucracy to sort of muddle the facts and roil the waters such that people will not become suspicious.
I no longer, the threshold has been passed for me some time ago with regard to their telling us untruths. What I want to know now is why? And what the real truth is.
That's right. That's the big issue. Good heavens, I could play tape after tape until the cows come home, but I've done plenty of that in the past. If people don't understand yet the fact that something of extraordinary nature is taking place, and I too find it very profoundly worrisome, it's almost as if our government is in cooperation with this.
I was about to say, if the cows did come home, they'd probably be mutilated.
Yeah. But this underscores the importance of this simple little task I do, sitting up here collecting UFO data, sifting through it, spending virtually my entire waking day trying to figure out what all of it means. I rarely know what it means. But the one thing it does allow me to do is distinguish between that which is true and that which is fabrication by the government, and there's becoming more and more of the latter.
Well, and one thing you've got to get used to, and I already have, Peter, and that is that when you're out on the edge and you're reporting breaking news and you're reporting what's going on, you're always going to take, when they officially issue their story the following day, you're always going to take heat, always, every single time. They're going to make you look like a fool.
Yep.
Until you can prove otherwise, and you have certainly done so with regard to the incident on the West Coast.
And it takes a great deal of work to do that, to assemble the proof. I mean, everything you say has to be corroborated. You have to never overstep your data, and that takes a great deal of time and effort. I noted that some of the more severe critiques of our work were released 12 hours after this incident. From my experience, it takes a great deal more time than that to even just collect enough facts to be able to sift through them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're finally the pieces are falling in place. One other cut I'd like to play, Art. It's a short one. I think it's just about 30 seconds long or so.
Sure.
This is a report we got from a gentleman who was just walking out of the Oregon State Fair in Salem, Oregon. This is the one that puts the aircraft in the air in proximity to that object we just heard described by this young lad at about the same time, both of them.
Okay.
And this is a rather interesting revelation on this gentleman's part. Here we go.
I was on September 1st in Salem, Oregon, at approximately about a quarter to 10, 9:50 right in there. I was at the Oregon State Fair, and I was leaving the area. I was going to my car to the parking lot and witnessed four, possibly five or six, military jets flying at a low altitude heading south. And they were going very fast and very low for their typical situation, very loud. I'm sure there was thousands of people that even saw it. I can't believe that the Air National Guard is even saying that it didn't happen. So
must have been thousands of people who saw that.
And again, talking to that young lady, I thought that was an incredibly important point. They would normally issue to the press press releases about this, and this is the biggest incident that's occurred since I don't know when, and this is the one time they didn't do it?
Yeah.
Come on.
Strictly coincidence, she assured me.
Of course.
You know, the other tragedy is that I've been in touch with a lot of newspapers down in Oregon trying to stimulate a little interest in this, and there has been some interest generated. But it took goading from the National UFO Reporting Center to get any of these journalists to probe more deeply into the issue than simply issuing the official statement that had come out of NORAD.
Precisely.
It's almost as if they have become subunits, spokesmen, mouthpieces for the government's official position.
Well, they have.
I think
so, too. And a lot of it is not necessarily intentional. It's just plain ass laziness. They're, you know, a lot of media, Peter, now is very lazy, and all they do is read what comes across the wire as though it was Holy Grail.
Yeah.
That's all.
Yeah. I was dealing with a journalist down in Central California recently. I will choose not to name the paper, but this journalist, when I mentioned NORAD, said, "What is NORAD?
What is NORAD?"
Didn't know what Cheyenne Mountain was.
You know you're off to a bad start.
I wasn't as polite as I know I should be with this person, and I won't even name the gender of this individual. I don't want to bring any grief upon them, but I was shocked at that this person who is looked upon by the reading public to come up with the truth of a matter doesn't know what NORAD is. That's something every six-year-old knew 40 years ago, for heaven's sakes. But this was a dramatic incident, and in view of the fact that we have fighters apparently going out after a very anomalous object, cast some light, I think, on the allegations that come out of Florida of the same thing with regard to those three F-16s that allegedly were incapacitated. We're still trying to get data on that case, but frankly, I'm just running out of hours during my day to go after all three of these major cases.
Sure.
But in view of the volume of other UFO reports that are coming to us, which is very high now, I'm not in the least surprised that this kind of case can take place and not garner any kind of publicity or interest on the part of the press or the public. They're coming by, they're going by me like a blur now, for heaven's sakes. I can't keep up with them. By the way, the fireballs are back, it appears. And what I'd like to do is sort of shift gears here, if I may.
You may.
We got a very interesting fireball report from Eastern Washington just this past Saturday. And in view of what this fireball allegedly did, and we got about five or six reports all described the same thing.
Oh.
Let me play what this thing looked like to the witness in Spokane as she was standing on her balcony in her apartment building, and I'll just let her describe what happened. Here we go.
Calling from Spokane, Washington. About 5 minutes ago, at about 8:25 p.m. Pacific time, I was standing out on the deck of my apartment, enjoying the nice clear night sky, looking at all the stars. Something out of the corner of my eye caught my attention. I was looking south from where I was at. Object, what I thought at first was a shooting star. It was not a shooting star. It got bigger. It got brighter. It came to a complete stop and then went straight back up the opposite direction that it came from. And then it was gone in a blink. It must have, total sighting must have been about between 5 and 10 seconds altogether.
So the object came to a complete stop, and then it went straight up in the nighttime sky. You may recall this is similar to what we heard from Utah on the 1st of September, people reporting things doing U-turns, splitting in twos, threes, and fours, and going shooting off in various different directions.
Oh, yes.
And this incident in Spokane, actually the object was first seen over northern Idaho streaking to the east, and it slowed down and stopped and did what this young lady described, apparently. But it leads me back to the fireball case over New Mexico on the 15th of August. I've discovered that there was an even more dramatic sighting that was captured on the Sandia National Laboratory's sky camera.
Really?
That they're trying to do away with as well.
What do you mean, do away with?
Well, they don't want to deal with it, apparently, Art. And this is information I've received just yesterday.
Okay, we're so short on time. What exactly did they see or capture?
They saw a huge, dramatic flash of light. The details of it I don't know, but it was every bit as dramatic as that event on the 15th, sky camera images of which you've seen. And they don't want to send out investigators to talk to the eyewitnesses. It's a lamentable situation when you hire PhDs as federal employees and they don't want to believe the data that's laid in their lap, so they're going to ignore it.
Well, you're calling them. So what are they saying about it? I mean, when you call and say, listen, I'm Peter Davenport calling from UFO Reporting Center in Seattle. We want to know about the gigantic flash. When you ask about that, what do you get?
That's a good question. I'm happy to answer it. I get no return phone call from the chief scientist on this project. He's ignored me for 3 weeks and refused to return 5 phone calls. That makes me a little bit annoyed, I must say, since they were the ones who invited me into their group to contribute data to their project, and of course, gratis. So we have people who are engaging in denial, as I think I mentioned last time. They are accruing data that they don't know what to do with because it doesn't fit their preconceived notion of the universe. And the same thing is happening up here in the Northwest, I understand, from Sandia again. Some of the scientists up here are seeing fireballs in one sky camera that do not show up in another sky camera, perhaps only 10 or 15 miles away. Now, if those fireballs are as high as meteors must be, 50 or 80 miles in the sky, they should be being picked up, and yet they're not. And apparently the scientists are having some difficulty trying to rectify what is going on here.
Well, in the field of archaeology, a similar thing goes on, Peter. When an archaeologist finds something, as a general rule now, that does not fit in with what general archaeology says this piece of whatever it is should be, they take it and they put it in a shelf in the back of a museum somewhere, and they don't talk about it because they can't figure it out.
Yeah. That bone has the wrong shape, so we'll ignore it.
That's right. That's exactly right. And that's I think, what's happening here.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Denial by dissertation. I think there's a lot of it. Not invented here, so we'll ignore it. Yeah. Well, I hope at some future time I'm able to report to your listeners that there's been a resolution to this problem, that we have an explanation for that flash and some of these other events. But they are certainly mysteries at this point, and in my view, unexplained by rational, objective, traditional pedestrian terrestrial explanation. They just don't fit.
You've got to imagine that it's possible that we're dealing with a military experiment of some sort as well. In other words, that's one alternative explanation that would be greeted with the same kind of less than fully enthusiastic, detailed explanation.
Mm-hmm. Well, if it's our hardware, it's a quarter mile long, it can outfly an F-15, and it can hover motionless. I am impressed with the engineers that can design and build those things.
That is impressive. In the next hour, I'm going to have Dr. Stephen Greer on. And as you know, he is well convinced that we are being visited.
Yes.
Have you come to the same conclusion yet? Or, in other words, are you beginning to topple toward extraterrestrial visitation as the only reasonable answer?
Yeah. There's very little remaining doubt in my mind. That is my conclusion. That is the conclusion of most serious-minded investigators, not just in the United States, but around the world. We are dealing with sophisticated craft that are under intelligent control. That's my belief. And the government doesn't want us to think about this. I recently stumbled upon a fascinating little book by an American author. His name is William Dudley Pelley, very well known in the 1920s and 30s. 7 Minutes in Eternity. He rented a bungalow outside Los Angeles in 1929, and one night he found himself going up a tube of white light, and he arrived in a round room, or an oval-shaped room with curved walls. He was lying on a very cool table, and he reports in that book that he saw friends who had long been deceased in that room, and he spoke with them. Now, some have concluded it might have been a near-death experience, but it is a fascinating account, and it dominated this author's life until his death in, I think, the late 50s or 60s. He wrote copious quantities about that incident.
Well, who's to say that near-death doesn't equate to close encounters? Peter, we are utterly out of time, so we can't give out the normal information, but there is a hotline if something's going on right now, folks, for breaking news, as it were. Peter Davenport, thank you so very much.
Thanks again, Art. I've enjoyed it.
Good night, Peter.
Good night.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from September 16th, 1999. Presents Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight's program originally aired September 16th, 1999.
The very objective Peter Davenport was on last hour with a whole bunch of reports of things that absolutely could not be re-entering Russian missiles. Things that hovered, things that went up instead of down, and so forth and so on. He is beginning to lean heavily toward the inescapable conclusion that we are being visited from elsewhere. And I think that, too, is the conclusion reached by Dr. Stephen Greer of CSETI, and he'll be up shortly. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Hey, Art, this is Phil in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, WTMJ.
Yes, sir.
Hey, I have a couple questions for you. Back in March, you had an email from George Carlin, and I was wondering if you ever...
You're right. I had an email from George Carlin. He's a fan of the show. He wants to come on. He was doing a... He said an HBO special at the time. George, we're ready for you now. I forgot all about that. You're right.
Yeah, because I just read he was in Las Vegas recently in the last few months, and I don't know if you caught him or not. I haven't seen him in like about 7 years, but he's just, he's one of the best.
I did see his HBO special, as a matter of fact. The guy is pretty irreverent.
Yeah, he's definitely got an eye on everything, too. he even talks about the weather a lot, too.
Well, he's right.
I think he's the greatest thing. If you did get him on, he does have a sharp belief in UFOs. And every time I've seen him on TV, he never mentioned it. One time he did, and
I wonder. You know, you've seen his specials, right?
Oh, definitely all of them.
Do you think he could behave himself enough over a period, say, of 2 or 3 hours?
I don't think so, but he staunchly believes in this stuff, and I really would like to hear what he says. Back on the George Carlin show, he even mentioned cattle mutilations as in a joke, so I know he's into it. And
hey, look, even South Park is doing stuff on cattle mutilations.
Are they? Okay.
Yeah. All right, listen, thank you for reminding me. George, email me.
Yeah, you can definitely get him on there.
All right.
Yeah, okay.
All right, thank you very much. Yeah, George sent me an email and said he's a big fan of the show and would love to come on and was working at that time on an HBO special. So, yeah, hey, good idea. Boy, I'm glad you reminded me. So much has happened that that one escaped me. But, yes, we should have George on. Now, again, could he behave himself? That would be an interesting test. Sufficiently to have him on 2 or 3 hours. I know the man has a very great deal to say, but sometimes the way he says it. Then on the other hand, he was the author of the, what was it, 7 deadly words that must not be said on broadcast radio or TV or something. So he knows them. Heaven knows he knows them. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi.
I can't believe I actually finally got through to you.
You have.
Well, Art, a long-time listener, first-time caller.
Yes, ma'am.
My name is Nicole. I'm from Sacramento, California.
Right.
The other night, you had made a statement. You were wondering what is causing all of these people to go out and shooting up a whole bunch of people.
Right.
Well, I have kind of an answer for you.
Okay.
When there is an incident, other people tend to follow. If there's an assassination, a few weeks later, there's going to be another assassination.
I have such a hard time wrapping my mind around that. I understand the copycat theory, but, you know, look here. We're talking about children going into a school with bombs and guns and killing other children. We're talking about somebody in their 40s going into a church and just killing as many people as they can before killing themselves. And I cannot get my mind around the concept that they're doing it because somebody else did it. I mean,
doing it because of it. They see that as a viable way to get forth their message. Somebody else did this. Wow. You know, that might help me.
To get their message out, huh?
Whatever their message might be. Now, like in Littleford, the kids that were shooting their friends as they came through the woods is very much like Leopold and Loeb. They did it just because to see what it was like.
Yeah.
The idea is there. I bet if you went through these kids' houses, you would find books that are on these people. Like, do you remember the Hi-Fi killings?
Mm-hmm.
The Hi-Fi murders.
I do, yes.
They were inspired by the Dirty Harry, the second movie, with the bleach, with the hydrochloric acid from that scene when gave the prostitute that bleach or the cleaning solution.
Yeah.
They were inspired by that. That is why they used that specific method.
Well, that backs into the whole argument of, you know, the media and the pop culture and all the rest of it. And I watch all that stuff. I watch movies that really are violent. I mean, I don't
it
mind
it. It only affects those that are already criminally minded.
Aha.
It spurs them
Thank
on.
You.
It's not going to affect,
right.
you know, you and me.
Right.
It's going to affect those that already
you're right.
have that
you're,
identity.
You're right. You're right. So what are we going to do? Are we going to stop Hollywood? Are we going to pass laws about what you can and cannot depict because somebody in Timbuktu is going to say, aha, here's the way I'm going to do it?
No, what it is getting the awareness out to parents that it starts with them loving their children, teaching them the right things, and not abusing their children and bringing them up in such awful environments.
Well, then how then do you account for the children that have not come from broken homes, ghetto existences, street life, all the rest of it? They've come up middle class or even sometimes better, brothers who would kill their parents for the money, the inheritance, shotguns, blast them in half, you know, people from good homes,
right.
even
now,
loving homes that just snap.
I cannot explain those, but I'm sure there are some criminologists out there that could possibly shed some light on this. Now, most of my information that I've gotten in criminology, I've been studying criminology for 13 years, have been coming from people such as John Douglas, if you know who he is,
mm-hmm.
and Gavin DeBecker from his book Gift of Fear, if you ever read that one, which is an outstanding book. It shows these people's minds the way that they work. Now, and we all know that sometimes these people with high IQs also border on insanity. They walk that fine line. And then there's the medication thing. If they were on Prozac or Ritalin growing up. I know you had a show on there with Hilly Rose. That
did a show on Prozac or something, yeah.
Yeah, Dr. Tracy on there.
But you know what? I don't buy that. I don't buy it. There are a disproportionate number of people on these drugs that commit these crimes. But remember, these are the people who have been diagnosed with some sort of illness requiring that kind of drug. So I think suggesting that, gee whiz, that drug is actually causing the people to do this is way out of line.
Oh, no, I'm not saying that they're compelled. They still have the brain capacity to choose. These people are not compelled by any means to do these acts.
Yeah, but I don't like the suggestion that the drug itself is
what is already there.
Many more people, in my opinion, are helped by Prozac.
Oh, yes. I think it also depends on your brain chemistry.
People who are able to live stable lives who otherwise wouldn't be stable at all.
I fully agree with you. I mean, look at the lady that was in Superman. I can't remember her name.
Lois Lane.
Yeah, Lois Lane. The lady who played her was bipolar.
Yes,
if it was not for the medication, she would not be as healthy as she is now.
You are dead flat right, as I recall. She was found in a really unusual situation in a yard. There was a story about it. I hopefully she's okay now. She's right. No, I don't buy into this argument about psychiatric drugs. It's just that we perceive that more crimes of this sort are committed by people who are using these drugs. But remember, these are disturbed. The model is of a disturbed person. And those are the people that are getting these drugs. So naturally, there are going to be a disproportionate number of them that end up, going the wrong way. The story that is not told in these scare tactics about these drugs is how many people are helped and live healthy, viable lives as a result of proper medication and dosage. And it's very important that they find the right level for that person. All right. In a moment, ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Stephen Greer coming up next.
Coast to Coast AM has a new name. Coast Insider. You'll still get all the same great features for the same low price. The package includes podcasting, which automatically downloads shows for you, and the iPhone app. You'll also get our amazing download library of 3 full years of shows. That's over 1,000 shows for you to collect and enjoy. If you're a fan of Coast, you won't want to be without Coast Insider. Visit coasttocoastam.com to sign up. Now we take you back to the night of September 16th, 1999. On Art Bell, Somewhere in Time.
Dr. Stephen Greer has been heading the CSETI organization for a long, long time. And I'm going to let him tell you what CSETI is. Dr. Greer, what an honor to have you on the program.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Dr. Greer, how long have you been doing all this?
Well, it's been 9 years now. I think in August we formed CSETI in August 1990, so about 9 years.
9 years.
Yeah, it's been quite a journey.
Have you, Peter Davenport, who is just sort of an objective collector of information and observer, in the first hour, finally, just said it. The evidence appears to be incontrovertible. We are being visited. You share that that view, correct?
Absolutely. And I just have a new book out that puts the very best of that evidence and a great many top secret government documents, which are smoking guns, in one place,
So
people can really see that. And I think that anyone who does an objective review of the evidence will have to conclude that these are definitely real objects and that a substantial number of them are very likely of extraterrestrial origin.
What is the name of your book?
The name of the book is Extraterrestrial Contact, The Evidence and Implications. And it's not a general release yet. It can only be obtained on a website or through an 800 number. You can get it through www.drgreer.com. It's drgreer.com or 1-888-DR-GREER. That's drgreer.
And we've got a link on our website for you tonight.
Right. And interestingly, you know, with the events that happened that are happening out west, we had a CSETI advanced expedition up on Mount Shasta last week, and we were up at about 6,000 or 7,000 feet, about 25 of us, and on three out of the nights we were there, three out of the seven nights, we had massive, and I mean at least 10-mile diameter triangular formations, which appeared the first night directly overhead. And to give you an idea of this, this would be like three stars, as bright as Venus, appearing, materializing directly overhead, very high up. They moved as if they were rigidly attached, and as they moved across the sky, separated somewhere around 10-mile diameter, we're estimating because we don't have a triangulation point, but it was massive. It would block out, this whole triangular formation would block out other stars, but in a sort of quasi-transparent way. It was very unusual. And these things appeared in response to some of the Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind protocols we use, where we go out and attempt to establish contact with these objects. And we had just had a very profoundly deep session out there, and we were using a series of lasers and tones that were being carried on the lasers as sort of a carrier wave, and bam, this thing appeared overhead. It moved.
And you're saying it was how big, please?
It's very difficult. We're just given a rough estimate from looking at some of the film footage we got of two of the three points of this triangle, which are the only two that we could get in the field at a time because it was so massive. These points had to be separated, the three points of this massive triangle, by somewhere around 10 miles in diameter. Now, anyone looking at the sky, unless they were looking straight up, and were not, you had to be really looking because these objects, the three points of this, the three corners of this triangle, appear to be very similar to very bright stars, except obviously they weren't because they were moving in front of the stars and they were much brighter and they were hooked together as if they were moving in a rigid platform. In fact, the thing even tilted and turned, and it was much larger than the Phoenix Light.
How, if I may ask, were you able to discern a tilt and a turn by observing where the the background stars and so forth.
By the shape of the object and the way it moved across the sky, it definitely made a turn, and then it tilted on its axis. In other words, one star, what looked like a star, one point of it, very bright lit front of bluish-white object, stayed stationary, and the other two would then sort of tilt around it, and then it would move on.
Gotcha.
It was very extraordinary, and of course, over 20 witnesses to this, and some film footage of two of the three points of this triangle, but we couldn't get all three of them in because the field was so huge. And, you know, this whole concept of people going out attempting to do this sort of what I call real-time research is what one of the things that CSETI has been doing, and I describe that very thoroughly in the book. We know we had a near landing of one of these objects in Mexico in 93, and that account is in this book, as well as the near landing in Alton Barnes, England, in 1992. Now, the weird thing about this particular craft on Mount Shasta last week, and I have to tell you, this happened three different nights. I mean, it was astonishing to all of us. And I've done this all over the world for 9 years, and this was one of the most astonishing encounters we've ever had, is that it appeared in a perfect equilateral triangle, which is the CSETI logo. It's the CSETI shape, which had appeared in a crop circle in England after we had sent that shape up to the ETs back in 1992, and a crop circle appeared in a field. And, you know, the number of coincidences around this event are a little bit too much to think that this was a chance sighting, particularly because it recurred three nights in a row. And it was seen by other people out in the Mount Shasta area.
Same object three nights in a row?
Correct.
Wow.
And it was massive. Now, what's interesting is that we have, you know, been doing this for, as I mentioned, about 9 years. And you know, the book that I just wrote, unfortunately, doesn't have this Mount Shasta event in it because the book just came out, but so did that event. But what we have found is that there's a tremendous degree of interactivity between people and these objects, which is highly anomalous. And to get into how anomalous this is, you have to begin to understand the nature of extraterrestrial communication systems, which we have discovered can interface directly with coherently sent thought. And this, of course, is very unusual. I've been called worse names than you have, Art, for saying this, but I'll have to tell you that, you know, this is not your granddad's Oldsmobile. These things are very advanced, and they have advanced artificial intelligence associated with them that can directly interface with consciousness.
Doctor, why, and it's too big a question for the bottom of the hour here, but why are they responding? You mentioned lasers, and you mentioned other protocols for contact of these craft.
Right.
Why would they toy with us? In other words, why would they respond to a mental thought or a laser beam modulated in some manner or some other attempt at contact by only showing themselves? In other words, what's going on here? Is this a demonstration?
It is definitely, it's a demonstration of the highly interactive nature that humans can achieve with these life forms if they do it within a certain context, a context which is nonviolent, a context which is mutual, and that's exactly what CSETI has been doing. We set aside all the rumors and prejudice and fear-mongering and alien invasion scenarios, and we say, look, if these things are under intelligent control and we're intelligent, let's find a way to do something that is interactive and which can be shared by a number of people, so it's not just an anecdotal story that one person saw. You know, when we have done this literally with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people who have seen these objects, which have appeared and which have interacted with our teams. And what I say to people is that this is a clear signal from these visitors that they are willing to interact with humans if we do it in a way that is sensible and which is calm.
All right, Doctor, hold it right there. We'll be right back. Dr. Stephen Greer of CSETI is my guest. This is Coast to Coast AM.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from September 16, 1999. listening to Art Bell Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from September 16th, 1999.
Well, I'll tell you, there's nothing like an actual sighting to make you a convert, like the pastor last week, who was a sudden convert just before 5 o'clock in the morning. Remarkable. And what Dr. Greer and 20 other witnesses saw and photographed was remarkable. So, obviously, something is with us. And that's what we're talking about with Dr. Stephen Greer. He'll be right back.
You're listening to Art Bell Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from September 16th, 1999.
Dr. Greer, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
These things are going on in our skies over Mount Shasta, as you and 20 saw. Millions of people are seeing these things. The ones attempting contact are having the most luck. So I think you're probably right about that. But the part I don't understand is why we get this close and we don't make contact. We don't actually have a landing and a meeting and a dialogue.
Well, you're assuming that's not happening, and I think that to get into a discussion of that is going to get into the discussion of some very deep questions of how that might happen in ways that are not altogether obvious all the time. And I like to relate this story, and I relate this story in a number of places and refer to it in this book that just came out, and that is that this Air Force officer called me who had been stationed at Las Vegas Air Force Base years ago, and he was one of these people in our pool of witnesses who'd like to come forward in some congressional hearings.
Here at Nellis Air Force Base.
In Las Vegas Air Force Base.
Oh, Las Vegas.
Different than Nellis. And he was up near, I think it's called Angel Peak there, radar installation.
Okay.
And anyway, he told me this story, and he related this incredible encounter that he and his buddies had had back in the 60s. And then he proceeded to say, well, the real reason I called you doesn't have anything to do with that. And I said, well, you know, go ahead and tell me. And he was very apologetic. And he said, well, I really am sort of embarrassed to tell you about this because it really has nothing to do with me being a military witness, and I'm afraid it'll ruin my credibility. And I said, go ahead and just tell me the truth. I'm a very open-minded person, and you can tell this to me in total confidence because I'm a physician and I'm used to keeping confidences. And so I finally got him to share what he wanted to say, and he said, well, years ago, and back in the early 60s, I was practicing to a technique to have out-of-body experiences. And I said, do you know what those are? I said, yes, of course. I've had many of them myself. Mm-hmm. And I've had a near-death experience when I was very ill when I was 17, so I understand this. He says, well, I was practicing this, and one night I had this experience and actually succeeded in having one of these so-called astral projections or out-of-body experiences.
Right.
And he, as he did this, he went out and he had what he called an uncontrolled launch. And he went up and through the ceiling of his house and slammed into the side of an extraterrestrial spacecraft with his astral body. And he said, now I knew you're going to think I've lost my mind, but the thing rocked. The spacecraft moved in response to my astral body. And then I popped onto the inside of it. And there were these extraterrestrial beings that were there who looked over at me as if to say, my God, why don't you watch where you're going? And, he was mortified, and he fell back into his body. Now, he asked me, he says, I know this was real. I know those were real ETs. He says, but how does my astral body, the thought visual body, actually move a craft? I said, well, you have to understand, these objects are not traveling through interstellar space in a solid materialized form. And when they make that quantum shift into another energy form in order to go through interstellar space, guess what? The form they're in is in an energy field that is very closely approximated to what you and I in the mystical community would call the astral body.
Well, then, Doctor, does that not suggest, and that's a fascinating story, first time I've ever heard it, but doesn't it suggest that instead of extraterrestrial contact as such, it may be extra-dimensional.
Well, no, this is the whole, you know, one of the things, the points I make, and I, about half of this book that I wrote, Extraterrestrial Contact, which has just come out, is about this very issue. How do we get our minds around something when we're trying to understand life forms, and they are extraterrestrials, so when they crash, when they're fully materialized, they have bodies that can be eaten by coyotes in the desert, et cetera, and so on. Now, how do you reconcile the physical reality with these other experiences? You have to expand your view of reality to include technologies and spectra of energy, which used to be relegated to the realm of the mystic or the realm of the philosopher.
Yes.
And I think that this does mean that they are multidimensional, but it does not mean that they're not extraterrestrial. They are extraterrestrial, and they're also interdimensional. In other words, you and I have physical bodies. We're sitting here talking on the phone, and we're sitting in our physical bodies. But we also have the ability to have a lucid dream, to have a precognitive dream, to have a near-death experience, like people who've come into my emergency department have had, where they've gone up out of their bodies and seen what's going on and reported it back. Now, that means that in reality, human beings are interdimensional, and that these life forms are simply able to technologically utilize a fuller spectrum of that reality.
Now, one quick question, Doctor.
Yep.
You mentioned your emergency room. When a patient has ceased vital signs for a period of time, do you, because of your specific interest, go to them and question them about what occurred?
No. Usually in those situations, you don't have time to do any such thing. However, I do get those accounts spontaneously from time to time. And particularly if later when they come back, if there's been a successful resuscitation and they come back and visit, if they know that you're an open-minded person, it's astonishing what they will share. In fact, it's astonishing what I've had, quite frankly, three-star generals at the Pentagon have shared with me about similar things. And I think that it's a matter of letting people know that you are not so hidebound, that you have to live only in your left brain and linear world. And what, you know, one of the things that I'm trying to present in this book is the idea that in order for us to ever understand this phenomenon, we're going to have to get out of the box of linear materialism, not throw away our scientific mind, but we're going to have to add to it our understanding of consciousness, of the conscious mind, of these other energy fields, which, in point of fact, can be electronically access.
Well, isn't it said that on the astral plane, when you travel, there is no real time reference or space reference, and there's no real limitation, because if you can visit other planets in your astral body, you are obviously defying the speed of light.
Of course you are, but remember, if you dematerialize, if I can use that term, an extraterrestrial spacecraft, between the time that it's dematerialized and rematerialized in another star system, what energy form is it in? You've just described it very closely, not exactly. It's similar. I want to be very clear. It's similar to that energy, but not identical. And that's why this military officer, when he had his out-of-body experience, could interact with this craft that was hovering in our atmosphere and actually move it. And by the way, the experience of being in that form of energy on a spacecraft is very similar to being in a very lucid, conscious dream. It may be why that area was called Dreamland, by the way, out there at Nellis Air Force Base. So, you get into an area here that's really through the looking glass, and I'll admit this sounds a bit far out, but, you know, look, it is not your granddad's Oldsmobile, and we're going to have to get really honest about the fact that these are life forms which are extraterrestrial, but they are, as you put it, also, it's not an either-or, but they are also, obviously, trans-dimensional, extra-dimensional, interdimensional, whatever you want to call it. Now, I don't think that it's that hard to understand that if we begin to understand the human reality. If we understand ourselves and the potential of human consciousness, as well as our physical reality, we will begin to understand our visitors. And I think that, in a sense, it's a very ironic thing that in order to understand the extraterrestrial phenomenon, we're going to have to first, as it has been said for many years, know thyself, and we're going to have to understand the human condition.
Hmm. That would account for an awful lot of what is explained in so many sightings, these things that seem to blink out or be sort of half here and half gone. All of these accounts that would appear to be only explained in our minds by an extra-dimensional transfer of some sort.
That's correct. And also, you have to remember, I'm working with a number of military and intelligence and aerospace high-tech workers who, as far back as the early 50s, were in controlled experiments dematerializing solid objects and rematerializing them at the other side of a hangar in a very controlled fashion. And, you know, I describe these things in this book that I've just written for the express purpose of making the point that we are going to have to view this as something which is not just a technology and a manifestation of a civilization using 20th century Earth stuff. By definition, if they're here and they're not from our solar system, they're going to be using technologies which are going to be almost totally magical to us. They're going to look like something out of a, you know, something metaphysical. But in reality, it is scientific. And I think that this is one of the things that I'm trying to point out, is that there is a science that can explain these things. And I don't think it's that far from what our current understanding is if we step back a few feet and look at it. And I think it'll become quite clear. One of the chapters in the book I call The Crossing Point. And in The Crossing Point, I talk about what happens when you go through the veil of light.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Art, this is a very big question. What's on the other side of the light barrier? We're always talking about the sound barrier and this barrier. But what happens when you go faster than the speed of an electron spin or a material matter or the speed of light? Will you enter into an entire dimension, a whole aspect of reality? And it's very real and it's very physical, which is totally outside of, as you put it, linear time and space.
Sure.
And therein lies a lot of the mysteries, why so many people have had experiences with these visitors within the conscious state, where they have seen an object, as our groups have done, and through directed thought, the object has interacted, moved here, moved there, blinked back and forth. Now, this all sounds very far out to people who don't begin to think about what the nature of our material universe is. And I, you know, Ed Mitchell and I have discussed this. I really feel that the entire material universe is simultaneously a conscious and knowing universe, and that it has this interactivity that is profoundly deep and on the level of thought and conscious existence. And I think that any civilization that is communicating through interstellar distances will have to have discovered this.
Well, Edgar Mitchell, as you know, believes that this is occurring. I interviewed Gordon Cooper the other night, Doctor.
Yes.
And he related his experiences chasing UFOs over Germany.
Right.
He related his experience in California when something with a sort of a tripod, I'm sure you've heard the story, that had a tripod landed, and he had the negatives in his hand, and they were whisked off to Washington,
right,
never to be seen again. The incident at Edwards is
sure
what I speak of. And he confirmed all of that on the air. And so here are two of our major U.S. astronauts saying, hey, folks, attention, they're here.
Right, exactly. And the Soviet cosmonauts are telling us the same thing, and we have film footage of them telling us the same thing. Back in 95, we organized a meeting in California where there were colonels and generals from the Soviet Union as well as military witnesses. Ed Mitchell was there, where these accounts kept coming out. And at the same time, this sort of what Dr. J. Allen Hynek called this high strangeness factor was also coming out. And what we're trying to do at CSETI is to put together an integrated theory where you don't have to say, well, look, these things are either interdimensional or they're extraterrestrial. It's quite obvious from our experiences out in the field, and we've spent thousands and thousands and thousands of hours out under the stars researching this, that it's both, material, but it also goes beyond material sciences into an area which clearly has some involvement with consciousness and thought.
I agree. But how do you bring the pragmatic scientists who will scoff and call you names, as you mentioned earlier, into even beginning to investigate the possibilities, even probabilities, that you and I are talking about with respect to this phenomena this morning. How do you get them there?
Well, what I've done, you know, I've recently had meetings with senior members of the National Science Foundation, very senior members of NASA, the Naval Research Lab, and other facilities. And what you do is that you start with the material sciences. You show them the evidence. But if they're intelligent and halfway open-minded, you then make this other step into a discussion about aspects of the universe which are outside of linear time-space, and you begin to introduce these other concepts. And believe me, I want to tell you a story. If people get on the website, www.drgreer.com, D-R-G-R-E-E-R.com, we have the introduction to this book, and it tells a very sort of poignant story of me sitting with the CIA director, with my wife, and at dinner for 3 hours in this meeting. And his wife is there, who is the head, the chief operating officer of the National Academy of Sciences, ostensibly a very high, well-regarded scientific position. And after much discussion like you and I are having, but not so much into the metaphysical area, she turns to me, and Dr. Woolsey, this is CIA Director Woolsey's wife,
right?
And she turns to me and she says, Dr. Greer, how are these things communicating through interstellar distances? And I swallowed real hard, and I thought, Jesus, do I tell her the truth?
Here we go.
Do I tell her something that would sound good?
Yeah.
And she turns to me, and I could see she really wants the answer. And I assumed, and I do this all the time, if someone asks me the question, I assume they're ready to hear the answer. So I turned to her, and I said, Dr. Woolsey, these objects and the life forms on board have technologies which go beyond the light barrier. And when you go through the veil of light, you get into an area where there are sub-electromagnetic resonance fields, scalar fields, which interface with thought and consciousness in a nonlinear way, in a way that allows you to communicate from one terminal to another, bypassing linear space and time. And she turned to me. Now, this is the punchline. Dr. Woolsey, head of, chief operating officer, National Academy of Sciences, turns to me and says, well, Dr. Greer, I thought it had to be something like that. Now, I'm telling you, I could have fallen out of my chair. And I thought, well, it shows the extent to which people really are ready to begin to get their minds around this stuff. But you have to go through it in a very systematic and quite frankly, very clear and articulate fashion, so that you can connect the dots in a logical fashion. And that's what we're attempting to do.
Well, you know, it's still going to be difficult. I mean, we have wonderful theoretical physicists like Dr. Kaku, who talk of multi-dimensions.
Right.
But somehow getting that theoretical probability from Dr. Kaku to the mainstream scientists who ought to be investigating all of this, because ET contact ultimately may come more in the metaphysical area than it does in the physical area. Yes, there is some physical evidence, but you know, it's pointing now more toward a metaphysical answer for contact than physical, and the scientists are not going to like that.
No. What you have to do is you have to pull it both together, and that's exactly what I'm trying to do in this new book. And by the way, one way to do it is to take these people out with you. Now, I'll give you an example. There's a tenured professor of hard sciences at the University of New Hampshire who is connected at a very high level to the National Science Foundation and to other big institutions. He heard about me through a top secret witness who is his cousin, an Eisenhower era witness who actually saw the Roswell remains. And this man contacted me and got involved with CSETI. I took him out to Joshua Tree Wilderness in Southern California on a training. And by the way, we're going there in November. People can find out about that at www.csseti.org. And what I did was take him out there. We engaged these protocols, which are admittedly really outside the box.
It's all right, we'll talk about that. This is a cliffhanger. We're at the top of the hour.
Oh, we are, okay.
Yeah, relax, and we'll tackle this one when we get back. So a PhD went out, huh? Now, this is going to be interesting indeed, because obviously the protocols work. And by the way, we will talk about those contact protocols shortly. This is Coast to Coast AM.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from September 16, 1999. Listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from September 16, 1999.
My guest, of course, is Dr. Stephen Greer. He said he's Dr. Stephen Greer. You may go to his new website by simply going to mine and scrolling down to his name and clicking on it. We've got a link right there for you. His new book, Extraterrestrial Contact, The Evidence and the Implications. And you can read a little bit about his new book up there, and I guess a little synopsis, or at least some part of it as well. Sounds like a pretty good deal to me.
Streamlink, the audio subscription service of Coast to Coast AM, has a new name. Coast Insider. You'll still get all the same great features for the same low price. The package includes podcasting, which automatically downloads shows for you, and the iPhone app. You'll also get our amazing download library of 3 full years of shows. That's over 1,000 shows for you to collect and enjoy. If you're a fan of Coast, you won't want to be without Coast Insider. Visit coasttocoastam.com to sign up. Weird stories on the radio? Must be Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
You know, when I started doing this radio program, Jesse, half of the subjects I was really into, the paranormal, the unusual, ghosts, and things like that.
Yeah.
The conspiracy stories, you know, I was a little weary about these, other than the Kennedy assassination. And all of a sudden, I woke up. I simply woke up. Is that what happened with you two?
Yeah, that's when I really started to say, what is going on here? And I started to truly then investigate 9/11. And today, I don't believe the government story of 9/11. Here's the three options. Either we knew about it and allowed it to happen, or we knew about it and participated in it, or these were the dumbest buffoons that could have ever been in charge of our country, who could have all this pre-information. And I started to think they knew what was going to happen. They either are part of it or they allowed it to. There's no doubt in my mind.
Now we take you back to the night of September 16th, 1999, on Art Bell, Somewhere in Time.
Now, back to Dr. Greer. Doctor, so you had yourself a PhD, and you were going to take him out with you and exercise the protocols. Could we talk about those a little bit, the protocols?
Yes. Let me get through this story first, because
All right.
I think it's very telling of what can happen. I mean, this is a man who you know, I mean, he's a university professor currently. He's very well respected in very senior scientific circles. And by the way, we've done this with a number of people. A very good friend of the UN Secretary General's came out with us to Mexico and had an incredible encounter. And we were there in Joshua Tree, and we're going to be there again in November, by the way. And we're doing the protocols that we use that involve not only light and lasers and tones that are sent on a laser carrier beam, as well as work that we do in consciousness. And we're doing this, and all of a sudden, an object the size, about a quarter to a third the size of a full moon, illuminates overhead about 60 degrees up and floats underneath the moon. And the moon is something like two-thirds full, three-quarters full. And even with that much moonlight, this thing is brilliant, silent, disc-shaped, lights up, moves across the sky, and then vanishes as quickly as it appeared. And, of course, here's a man who you know, you would think that if you went all over the world, you might see one of these things over a number of years. And this was his first expedition out, and here one of these things appear. And, of course, there are 30 other people there who see this, and he's astonished. So from that point on, you know, you don't have to do any more convincing, because he knows what he saw.
That's right.
Now, the same thing, by the way, was true with the CIA director. I spent, you know, people say, God, how much time did you spend with the CIA director talking about this? I said, about 10 minutes talking about the evidence. And anybody with an IQ over mud can look at the evidence and figure out that there's something real here. But the CIA director had already seen one of these things when he was younger, and he knew they were real.
Oh.
But even though he was CIA director, he could not get any information through channels from the government, which is why I was briefing him. And interestingly, the other 2.5 hours of our meeting were taking up with things like what Dr. Woolsey, his wife, asked. How are these things communicating through interstellar distances? Why are they here? How are they getting here? What does this mean to humanity? Who's keeping this secret, and why? I mean, these are the really big issues. You know, I find it depressing that, you know, 60 years after the world should have known these things are real, we're still having this sort of idiotic debate about, gee, you know, what the evidence is, when we really need to be dealing with these other issues, which are much more compelling and much more relevant, I believe.
Well, there's one issue you didn't mention. Dr. Jacobs wrote a book called The Threat, and his view of their presence is not necessarily one of they are our best friends, as you well know. And I wonder what your take on that is. After all, there have been abductions. There have been negative things that have resulted in contact for some people, even many people. How do you react to that?
Well, what I do, I try not to react. I try to do research. And what part of the research that I think anyone involved with this field has to do, and it's reflected very heavily in my new book, and that is, you have to go behind the scenes and go beyond what is obvious. You have to talk to people not only who have had these experiences, but you have to also talk to people who have worked counterintelligence programs and disinformation programs and who have reverse-engineered extraterrestrial communication systems which interface with thought and mind and consciousness, and see perhaps how those have been used to put out false information to hide the real phenomenon. And I think it's a much more complex issue than what's been presented so far in the abduction literature. For example, there are many people who may have had an actual extraterrestrial experience And is it possible then that they may be targeted or have on top of that piggybacked a false experience, which, if you will, is sort of a high-tech hallucination, a false experience? I think the answer is yes. As far out as that may seem, I've talked to too many people who have been inside so-called non-lethal weapon systems and high-tech electronic warfare system projects,
right,
where things way beyond what MK Ultra did with LSD, where they have done experiments with high-powered electronics to induce the kind of experiences that Jacobs and others describe. So I tend to be very reticent to get on the, you know, Independence Day, the sky is falling bandwagon, based on information which I think is only part information and perhaps nine parts disinformation. So I think we have to do very good research behind the scenes, much as you would in any other case where you have to really dig very deep and start peeling back the sort of concentric layers of disinformation and conjecture and try to get to what's really going on here. Now, to do that, you not only have to go out and, I think, meet the phenomenon head-on, which is what we're trying to do with the CE5 initiative, the Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind initiative, but you also, I think, have to go deep behind the scenes inside covert military and intelligence programs to find out what those capabilities are. Because if they have capabilities within secret government projects that could simulate many UFO or abduction experiences, you need to have that factored into your, what we call in medicine, your differential diagnosis. I mean, Art, it'd be like you coming to the ER and saying, I have chest pain, and as a doctor, I'd only have one diagnosis, heart attack, when it could also be a collapsed lung, or it could be a pneumonia, it could be 115 things. So we have to become more sophisticated in looking at all of these things and trying to sort out what part of it is real and what part of it is Memorex. And I think that this is not an easy task, and I think it's something you cannot be facile about the kind of conclusion. So what my perspective on that is to be open to any possibility, knowing how extraordinary this phenomenon is, but to be very reluctant to jump to sort of jingoistic and xenophobic perspectives. And the reason for that is that who would benefit from a sort of alien invasion scenario? Well, long term, it would be those militarists who would like to militarize space in the next century, mm-hmm. and who would like to prop up the $1 trillion a year global military industrial sector.
No doubt.
So I tend to be very, very skeptical of information which could be out there for some hidden agenda.
All right. Well, but in military intelligence, you assess capability first, but then you use ground assets and whatever else you may have to assess intention. In other words, what are you going to do with what you have? Now, we have an awful lot of reports about what these craft seem to be able to do and very little information about their intentions.
Well, I actually don't think so. I think there are a wide array of people who've had various experiences where the intentions are quite clearly conveyed. And I'm going to tell your listeners a story now which I recount in this book, and I don't know that if it appears anywhere else, from Colonel Corso before he died. He met with a friend of mine and shared this story. This is not in his book, but he was at White Sands out in New Mexico, and back a number of years ago, I believe this was the early 60s, late 50s, somewhere in that time period,
mm-hmm.
and an object, one of these objects had landed, and there was an extraterrestrial that he was outside of the object and was communicating with the colonel and some of the other people there. And he invited these military people to come on board the object. Now, the object sort of disappeared, and when he looked, all he saw, this is in broad daylight, all he saw was this sort of wave in the desert, like a mirage, because it was translucent at that point.
Well, you're right. This was not in his book.
Okay, now listen on. Listen to this. This extraterrestrial life form told the colonel, now this is according to a good friend of his, I have no reason to believe this woman is lying, and said, you know, invited to come on board, and Colonel Corso, because of being a brash American military, I said, what's in it for me? and the extraterrestrial turned and said, a new world, if you can take it. Now, prior to that, the colonel had asked, are you friend or foe? And this ET life form said, neither.
Yeah, that would be a military response, friend or foe.
Yeah, and the ET said neither, which I think is very pregnant. In other words, I don't think that we should view them as foes. I don't necessarily think that they want to befriend the way we're living today. Look at our world. I mean, we're a civilization which in our century alone have killed several hundred million of our own people in warfare, have tens of thousands of nuclear weapons aimed at each other even to this day. I mean, you could forgive these life forms for being a little bit skeptical of, getting too cozy with the civilization, which has really kind of gone bonkers during this past 100 or 200 years of technological society, and which is on the brink of destroying the ecosystem of this beautiful planet Earth. So I think that we have to take a very long view at these things and not get caught up in the sort of xenophobia and hysteria, which is quite frankly the hallmark of so much ufology. And I think that because of that, our attitude is to say, well, let's kind of do what Colonel Corso did. Let's take teams out to areas where these objects have been seen and see to what extent we can establish contact and be open to the fact that it may be material, but it may be on other levels. It may be on a level where the object will not be fully materialized, but suddenly you'll see something start moving around you, and it's sort of scintillating and glowing. Now, I'll tell you, Art, we've had experiences which are pretty way out there, but they've been witnessed by 40 people at a time, and their mouths are dropping open because of the extraordinary nature of it. But it's not necessarily your granddad's Oldsmobile again. It's something that is, you know, sort of the sort of thing Colonel Corso explained. And I think that we have to begin to look at this with a very different lens from the sort of linear material existence that we are coming out of. And I want to remind people that it's only the recent civilization on Earth that has had to segue out of our material lives anything resembling a spiritual faculty. And I think that that's an aberration. If you go back to native cultures, ancient cultures, these things were integrated. I think if you're dealing with extraterrestrial cultures, they're kind of looking at these things with sort of this eye of oneness, this ability to integrate the conscious and the metaphysical with the scientific and the linear all together. And I think that if we're going to survive our own technologies, we're going to have to do the same thing.
I would like to read you something authored by Fred Moody. It appeared at abcnews.com. He's talking about a doomsday machine here, and it reads, "This doomsday scenario dovetails creepily with the speculation put forth by the late Carl Sagan in his book Cosmos. Sagan believed that we could never find evidence of life elsewhere in the universe because the pattern of evolution has been the same everywhere. Life begins, evolves through millions of years to the moment when it destroys itself. The nature of consciousness is such that evolution itself is a doomsday machine." Sagan considered nuclear war the most likely cause of destruction, but the creation of an annihilating black hole is more plausible. You can go all over the place with that. But basically, Dr. Sagan was saying civilizations are born, they have a short life, cosmically speaking, and die.
Well, see, I would use the argument that the existence of these extraterrestrial life forms, which I think is beyond a doubt. I mean, I have spoken to so many military people who have dealt directly with the technologies or the bodies or things that are, you know, just beyond question, not to mention the things I have personally seen. And what that says to me is that there's hope. I mean, in fact, if multiple civilizations, and I think there are several dozen of them at the least that are out there, have existed long enough to go through the nuclear barrier technologically,
yes,
and go through,
yes,
the crossing point of light technologically,
yes,
and are observing this planet and maybe have been observing it for a long time, I think that's a really very hopeful discovery, because what it says is that perhaps we can transcend this sort of violent monkey mind part of ourselves and get to a point where we can establish a civilization which can endure peacefully and in an advanced technological way for millennia from here, this point onwards. And I think that that is the case. I think that is the destiny of the human race.
But it may well be that those who make it evolve from the material, the physical, even the hard scientific. Who is to say that these beings are in ships as we understand them, physical ships as we understand them, even though once crashed or occasionally they manifest themselves in that way, that they do not evolve from the physical and material in order to be in this realm where there is not time, where there is not space?
Well, I think you learn to get to a point where you understand that even the human reality is very much there. If you have a meditative experience, that is what the ancients called samadhi, or if you have a go to bed and have a lucid dream and find yourself seeing something that happens a year or two or 20 years later, an experience I've had. I met my wife this way in a lucid dream that was precognitive. You begin to understand that it's not such a big leap to be able to see that you could have a physical existence, as we would think of it materially, with material spacecraft, but begin to understand spectra of energy that are wrapped within that same reality of material existence, that you can begin to access to step outside of linear space-time, not only for space travel and communication, but for other things. And I think that's what we're encountering here. I think it's actually very fascinating and in a very real sense, very hopeful that it does indeed exist.
What are you going to do with all your witnesses?
Well, this is the $64 trillion question. We have asked, and I've continued to have meetings in Washington over the past year, to encourage these open hearings. Now, I'm not sanguine that that's going to happen unless there's first some kind of civilian push. But the question is, how and where do you do that? You know, you just don't rent a ballroom at the Holiday Inn in Tucson or someplace and expect it to be taken seriously by the media. And to put on anything that would be suitable would be a very, very difficult task. And we have a plan to do this. And, in fact, the whole plan, completely unedited,
Doctor,
is in this book. And I would encourage people to read it and find out how they can help us get this done.
All right.
We're ready to do it.
Hold it right there. We'll be right back. Dr. Stephen Greer is my guest. This is Coast to Coast AM.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from September 16th, premier radio networks presents Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight's program originally aired September 16th, 1999.
All those witnesses, what is a mother to do? All that evidence, all those high-powered witnesses, Dr. Greer has got them. The question is, what are we going to do with them? We'll be dealing with that exact question in a moment.
Now, we take you back to the night of September 16th, 1999, on Art Bell, Somewhere in Time.
Once again, Dr. Greer and all those witnesses, you have high government officials, you have scientists, you have well-placed people who have seen things and know things ready to come forward, maybe 100, more than 100.
I've got about 200.
Oh, 200 now, is it? Peter Gersten, you know I'm going to ask you about this, was going to depose you and Peter Davenport. Peter Davenport said if he was deposed, he would indeed give up the information he had. I believe you have been quoted as suggesting you would not. Is that correct?
Actually, Peter Gersten has never called and spoken to me. The only time I've ever heard from or about him is when he has put highly critical and inflammatory things out on the internet or sent very argumentative missives. There's a certain way to comport oneself, and there's a certain way to behave, and I think that it doesn't inspire confidence when there's not a dialogue. And I think that the other issue, and this is something which we're very sensitive to, is that we have a specific goal in having these people come forward, and that is to have a definitive, serious disclosure take place.
I understand.
Now, if the strategy which somebody is putting forward is fatally flawed, and we know it is because we can run the strategy. We have people who have been at everything from the RAND think tank to the CIA working with us, I mean cooperatively, and we know it's going to fail. There's no point in risking people's perhaps lives, certainly coming forward in a way that would be a misfire. So our goal is very simple, and that is to have a setting, a venue, a strategy which gets the job done. Now, with that said, let's talk about something like a FOIA request. I know some of the guys who've answered FOIA requests on this and other issues.
Mm-hmm.
Now, those people don't have access to things which one would make an inquiry too, because the way that a super secret government program works is that it's unacknowledged. And I have a whole chapter in my book that we've been talking about that talks about unacknowledged special access projects, USAPs. Now, having worked with a number of people in these projects, because they're unacknowledged, it doesn't matter how large they are, people who are in other aspects of the Department of Defense, even if they were honestly trying to find everything they could for you, would find nothing on those unacknowledged projects. And this is part of the problem. If the CIA director and if Webb Hubble, on behalf of the president, could not get straight answers, I doubt that some functionary who fulfills FOIA requests would get such information, even if they had people coming forward saying, well, I saw this on this date and this time, and I know a document was generated, they'd say, well, fine. So the issue is that if it's something which is going to be an effective strategy, we're, you know, look, the whole world is as welcome as the flowers in May to help us get this done. But if it's fatally flawed because there's a lack of sophisticated understanding of how unacknowledged projects really work, then really we can't take the risk. And I'm going to say something here that's a little bit shocking perhaps to some people, but we've had some collateral damage in this effort. I mean, I've been working for 9 years on this, have foregone and put somewhere around $2 million of my own time and money into it, have also seen people suffer tremendously at trying to help us get this done, have taken huge risks,
I'm sure,
to set up the kind of meetings. I'm not, and I'm, you know, we have had some serious losses, and that's all I'm going to say on the public airways. Now, I'm not willing to put people in harm's way for an ill-thought-out strategy, which we know from the get-go is fatally flawed. Now, this gets to the question, is that then how do you do it? I mean, obviously, a presidential commission would be great. Clinton's not going to do it. He's terrified of taking this issue on.
I agree.
And the same thing for members of Congress that I've met with. I mean, I've sat for long periods of time with chairmen of committees, with senators on the Senate Intelligence Committee. And what I can say is that the people are going to have to lead this charge, but we're going to have to do it in a way that's rational and that gets the job done. And that's the only criteria that we're looking for. And if that can be set up, hey, we're ready to roll. We've been ready to roll since 1994.
All right, then. I have something I want to say to you, and it is the following. I am in possession of some secret information that must remain secret for the time being and not for very long.
Right.
When the time comes, I will present you with what I am certain you will consider to be the proper venue. And all I ask is that at that time, you seriously consider it.
Certainly. I certainly will.
All right.
And believe me, this is a decision not made by me alone. And at the risk of sounding a two-bit clandestine here, the people I'm working with are major players. I mean, you know, one of my military advisors is someone that if a member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff hears his voice in the corridor, will say, hey, is that blank, you know, say his name, is that you? I mean, these are not people that I'm going to put into some kind of a carnival sideshow.
Understood.
Or into an ill-thought-out program. This is serious as a heart attack stuff, and I know a lot of stuff that goes on in the UFO community I think is really a play and a pastime and an intellectual sparring contest. This is very serious stuff. I mean, the people who have taken risks to set up meetings with the CIA director, to take me to the Pentagon and meet with people who are some of the most powerful military leaders in the world, I mean, this is not child's play, and you take this very seriously. So all we really ask, and I appreciate what you're saying, Art, is that we have the ability to do this in a way that's credible. Now, I've had people in the media come and say, gee, we'd love to do a story like this, but what they propose doing would look like something tabloid.
I know.
Like what, unfortunately, Whitley Strieber's piece came out on NBC in February or March of this past year.
Confirmation.
And it was horrific. I mean, everyone I know in media on the Hill and the Pentagon who saw it just rolled their eyes and went, boy, that sets you back 20 years. So the issue is, how do you do this in a way that gets it out of the sensationalized gutter, does it in a very well thought out and serious fashion at a level, at a venue that would be truly taken seriously? Because if it's not taken seriously and you're just preaching to the choir, there's no point putting people at risk.
All right, well, I can't say any more right now, but at the right time, I promise you shortly I will come to you, and you will be presented with a venue, and I think you'll accept it, and I'll leave it at that. Listen.
Wonderful.
Let's throw Gerstmann a little bone. He has been out there in the trenches working hard. Do you understand his frustration?
Oh, I understand everyone's frustration. I mean, all of us, you know, have been frustrated with trying to find a way around this. The problem is that we don't need to reinvent the wheel. You know, one of the things that I've done, you know, I tell people, look, I'm just a country doctor from North Carolina. But you know what? We put a vision out there, and there's some wonderful people who collected around it, people who are some of the top people in strategizing this kind of problem, who are in Washington, who are at the Pentagon. We know how to get this done. We don't need to reinvent the wheel, and we don't need to be going on wild goose chases into blind-end corridors. And I think that that's the only thing that we ask. Now, I'll admit that there are a lot of people who have done a tremendous amount of work in this field, but it doesn't mean that we're going to fall on our sword and just sort of offer up all these names. For one thing, I don't have permission to tell you or anyone else who these people are unless they approve of the strategic plan and the venue for coming forward. So it's not like I'm going to, you know, I take a confidence very seriously, both as a physician and as a director of CSETI. If someone comes to me and says, I'm a scientist who's worked at Bell Labs, and I worked on extraterrestrial communication systems, and this and that and the other thing, and it's extremely, exquisitely sensitive information, I'm not going to violate that person's identity for something that's not going to be approved by him or effective to the cause, to what we're trying to get done here in terms of a credible public disclosure. So that's all we ask. I don't think that's too much to ask of these men who and women, a few of them, who are willing to come forward. They're just asking that it be something that is going to be effective and not just another, unfortunately, situation like Colonel Corso got into, where mm-hmm. he, quite frankly, got into, I'm going to say something here that people aren't going to like. I sat with the executive producer of 2020, ABC News 20, and he said to me, after Corso's book came out and he got on the mashed potato circuit and showed up at the Roswell Carnival, the 50th anniversary, he says we wouldn't do an interview with him. No one in the mainstream media wanted to do it because of the way that was strategically handled. So there's the atmospherics and milieu of handling this are very sensitive because the subject is the butt of so many jokes already. And I think that for us to do this properly, we're going to have to look at the terrain around us and assess it and say, hey, you know, this is what we got to deal with. It ain't pretty, but we have to be realistic and deal with the realities that confront us.
All right. Well, there's big movement going on behind the scenes, and we'll be in touch. Now,
wonderful.
Let me leave it at that for now and ask you a question that somebody has faxed. I think it's a pretty good one. Dr. Greer, how does the concept of humans as interdimensional beings affect our interpretation of the near-death experience? Is the travel to the light a final migration and discovery of our multi-dimensional nature just before we die into extinction, or is it a ratification of those who think the fragile mortal body is not necessary for consciousness to continue?
I think it's the latter, and what a lot of people experience with that light is sort of a transition effect as they're separating from the physical body. And by the way, not everyone who has a near-death experience will have that particular feature to it. When I was 17, I was very ill, and I had a near-death experience, and I did not have that particular feature. But I had an experience that was incredibly transformative. It was very divine, quite frankly. And I was raised a very devout atheist. I say that jokingly. My parents were very strict agnostic atheists. And I had this most incredible experience with a divine being and in a state that was just wonderful. And it didn't involve that particular sort of light and tunneling. So not everyone experiences that. But I do believe my own experience and from other people I know and trust and who I know are honorable people and who aren't making any of this up, that the transition over to existence after the physical body dies takes various pathways, but the end result is that there's a continuity of conscious existence, including your memories, your associations with those who've already deceased, et cetera, and so on. And this is what I personally experience, and it's my personal belief, but it's not just my belief, it's what I personally have experienced. So it goes beyond a matter of article of faith. It goes into some degree of personal knowledge.
Yeah, well, let me make to you an argument that one of your colleagues might make about near-death experiences, and that is, the doctors say, well, it's the brain dying from the outside in. The light is, of course, the center of the brain, and the cells die from the outside in as they lose the oxygen they require, and all of that sort of stuff, and they lay it off to that. And to be honest, doctor, we have had lots of NDEs, but we've never had, at least since a couple of thousand years ago nearly now, anybody who actually came back from the dead. We can cool people down. All life signs will stop. We can operate on them. I'll put their blood back in, and voila, they come back alive, and they are the same person. But after 2 or 3 days, I don't know of anybody who's been back yet.
No, I haven't either. I haven't met an ER doc yet that can pull that one off.
Precisely. So, how do we know that what we experience and what we tout and what we believe about NDEs is not the function of a living or, perhaps better said, dying brain?
Well, I think because there are many people who have experienced that have had that experience where there have been things seen and known which clearly indicate that the conscious individual was outside the body and observing things which they could not have otherwise known or seen from the perspective that they saw it and knew it. And I think that, you know, part of the issue here is whether or not we accept the fact that, that our conscious existence is operating all the time on multiple levels. And I think people have experiences when they go to bed each night in the dream state.
They do.
Many of which they don't remember, which inform their lives, which may give them glimpses of the future, et cetera, and so on. And I know that this is, many of my scientific colleagues would publicly disagree with this, but you know what? When you close the door and have a heart-to-heart with many of these people who profess to be very linear scientists, you'll find that there's tremendous experience, even within their own lives, of this sort of thing. And I feel that the research into non-local consciousness, if I can call it that, into the experiences of consciousness are very profound and are very hard to explain away as you know, neurological misfirings as the brain is dying. And I really don't think that's the case. I guess all of us once in our life will know for sure, and that's when we finally do pass on.
Then is there a delineation in your mind between astral travel and the astral plane and our final destination when we really do pass away?
Oh, yeah, I think there's a very qualitative and quantitative difference. Personally, I have had out-of-body experiences. I've had experiences related to various states of consciousness as well as my near-death experience. But I don't believe that anything quite as it compares to the finality of the termination of the physical body and that transition. You know, when my assistant, Sherry Adamack, died
yes.
A year and a half ago, a week before she died, and I write this whole account up in a tribute to her at the front of this book that I've just put out, I had this incredible experience where I went into a lucid state of 7 days before she died and met her on the other side as we stood in front of this incredible site that was
wow.
Divine. And I knew she would die 7 24-hour periods later because I was told that and knew it in this experience. The night before she died, I flew out to Denver. Everyone was astonished. They said, "How? You know, what are you doing?" I said, "Well, she's going to pass away tomorrow morning." And I told them this experience. Well, as we stood around her bed and I was saying prayers for her, I looked at her and connected into her sort of spiritual state and connected her to what I understand the divine presence to be. And I said, "Sherry, go into the eternal light." And with those words, she took her absolute last breath, and there was a spirit, something that filled the room that was so beautiful, and everyone was affected. And you could actually feel almost like a breeze or a wind. And she left, and she went on, and you could tell that it was the most extraordinary experience, very much different than someone just having an astral projection or out-of-body experience. So I do think that's important. I will say this. I think it's very quietly I've done this as an emergency doctor. If someone passes away, I always say a little prayer for them. I think it's very important for us to understand that the individual, when they pass on, progresses very largely by the prayers and the assistance of those who love them and those who know them. So
God,
I always tell people to do that.
Doctor, has it really been a year and a half since Sherry died?
Yes, it has been. And, of course, that first year was pretty hard for me to take. She was my closest friend and, of course, closest colleague in all this work for 6 years, and, you know, she only lived 6 or 7 months after she got her diagnosis of cancer. And
I know.
As we sat in England, an account that's in this book, we sat in England right after she got her diagnosis, and we were in the upstairs room of this old manor house in England on a training expedition, and she had just found out, and I'd had a recurrence of my cancer, and we thought, quite frankly, we thought I would die first because my cancer is much more aggressive and much more...
Listen, we're at the top of the hour. Are you good to go?
Yes, sure.
Okay, stay right there. We'll be right back, and we will continue with that very dramatic story. Dr. Stephen Greer is my guest. Stay right there.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from September 16th, 1999.
Yeah. an old-time movie about a ghost from a wishing well. In a castle dark or a fortress strong, with chains upon my feet, you know that ghost is me. And I will never be set free as long as I'm a ghost you can't see. If I could read your mind, love, what a tale your thoughts could tell. Just like a paperback novel, the kind the drugstore sells. When you reach the part where the heartaches come, the hero.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from September 16th, 1999.
This is an awfully pretty song, isn't it? Awfully pretty. It tells us really a lot about ourselves and what we believe about ourselves if you listen very carefully. Dr. Stephen Greer will be right back.
Looking for the truth? You'll find it on Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
I really believe that my role is to inform people, to try to bring them the truth. Yes, this is a program where we have some fun, and sometimes it's very, very unusual and strange. But I want them to understand what's happening in the world around them, whether it's climate change, economy, war, and the reasons for all these things. So that's what I think my mission is.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from September 16th, 1999.
I think all of ufology, which is very familiar, of course, with Dr. Greer and the late Sherry Adamek, was absolutely in shock when we heard the diagnosis that had been laid upon the two of them, and that's where we were going when the top of the hour came along and interrupted. Doctor, continue, please.
Well, I was relating this story, which really has a very interesting ET angle to it, and Sherry had just found out in June of 97 that she had this terrible metastasizing cancer, and I did as well. And we were sitting one night. She was very tired and didn't want to go out and do research in the field, understandably. And our research team was out on the lawn of this manor house in England. And we were sitting in the second floor sitting room of this huge manor house and that we were using as our research base. And we were there sort of commiserating with each other, quite understandably, but in a very sort of somber way. And suddenly, I saw this blue-white orb fly into the bay window of the room. It came over by the fireplace and then sort of semi-materialized as about a 3-foot-high humanoid form, but it was translucent and sort of sparkling. And, of course, this was it was certainly not a ghost. It was something quite extraordinary, and the sense of compassion and concern coming from this being was astonishing. Well, we would have never told this story to the world, except the next morning, unbeknownst to us, the people that we had out on the field outside, about half a dozen people, said that they saw this blue-white object come out of the sky, streak across the top of the trees, and go into this bay window. Well, they didn't know we were in that room until later. Of course, Ron Russell, who's a crop circle researcher, a dear friend of mine, he did the cover art for my book, by the way, beautiful job of space. He's a space artist. He said to everyone, well, that's where Steve and Sherry are sitting. And indeed it was. And so we had other people who saw this. Well, I would have never shared this story because we had corroboration. And the sense of it was profound, and we knew that there was some very serious concern. She only lived about 6 months after that experience. But, you know, she never gave up trying to get the truth out about this or to to go out into the field, go out into the night sky, and try to establish a peaceful connection to these life forms. In fact, in November of 97, 2 months before she died, she went out with about 30 or 40 of us up to Joshua Tree Wilderness, and every single night, even though she was had metastasis to her brain and was limping, only had partial use of her leg that was affected, went out every single night and braved the elements, because she wouldn't have missed it for the world. I mean, and so that's the kind of person she was. She had an indomitable spirit and just an incredible, incredible person. And her passing was really something blessed, I think. She had a wonderful passing, and she really never had any pain. This was the amazing thing. As a physician, I saw this, and I thought, oh, she's going to be in horrible pain. She wasn't. And she was lucid up to just a few days before she passed. And, you know, it goes to show that yes, we have material bodies, but there's a lot else going on. And I think the extraterrestrial people understand this and understand it in ways that makes it very clear to us in ways both profound and prosaic, just sort of everyday events that can happen.
As a doctor, how do you explain that? How does somebody go through something such a traumatic death? And lingering death, as Sherry did, without pain, while others do not?
It's a very good question. She had a few thousand people putting her in light and praying for her, and she herself was extremely adept at in the sort of experience of consciousness, and her spiritual faculties were very strong. And I think it just goes, it's a combination of things, and you do see this from time to time. But it was really an amazing thing to witness, and I think everyone who was with her in those closing hours of her life were really touched by this, and also touched by these sort of strange phenomena that happened around her passing, such as this event that happened on one of our training expeditions in England. I mean, it was absolutely astonishing. And this, by the way, this little creature, I don't know what to call it, was only about 3.5 to 4 feet tall. I mean, it was very short, but extremely compassionate and visible with the lights on. And I mean, you know, it was extraordinary. And of course, again, I would have never mentioned this. It ends up getting into this book that's coming out, because I wanted people to understand that not everything that happens of an extraterrestrial nature, you know, is as kind of coarse as it's presented often in the UFO field. I think it sometimes is profoundly subtle.
As you pointed out prior to the hour, you said you thought it very likely you would pass before she did. What is your state of health?
Well, I'm just fine as frog's hair, as they say down here in the South. I mean, I'm really doing quite well, and I have no right now. I've had a few recurrences of this problem, but I don't have any internal disease, and I'm actually incredibly healthy. I've been doing a number of things to keep myself healthy, and God willing, I'll stay that way. You know, and I'm grateful for this, because I have four children, and
of course, how does a physician, if you even care to discuss this, react to the news of his own pending mortality?
Well, it's not news to me, because when I was 17, I had the most incredible near-death experience, and it was still not easy because of the responsibilities I have. And you know, I don't mind the idea. I know everyone's going to pass away at some point, but I have a lot of responsibilities, and that weighs very heavily on me. Particularly because perhaps I haven't been able to. I've spent so much time trying to pursue these other goals, I haven't particularly reached my maximum earning potential as a physician. You know, I've been walking away from about $100,000 to $200,000 a year in income while I've been doing this work. But I think that aside from those practical concerns, the way I've reacted to it was to focus on achieving the things I wanted to achieve. A lot of people ask me, why did you come out with this book now? And I said, well, there's information in this book, for example, on one of the sections that lists literally all the facilities that these top secret witnesses have told us about. I mean, naming them by specific facilities, the entire Edwards facility, the Northrop Anthill Tejon Ranch, the Lano plant, the Blackjack Control and Tabletop Mountain Observatory. All of these sort of things that are listed in this book. And many of these things are things that we put in here so that the public would be able to see the scope of what really exists and the kind of work that's been done, because you really don't know how much longer you're going to have. I mean, I hope I live to be as long as God wants me to be on this earth. But then again, you know, I saw Sherry go from perfectly healthy hiking around in the wilderness to being buried 6 months later. So it does focus your attention on what's important, quite frankly. And that's why we have redoubled our efforts since that happened.
You mentioned a secret source. There was word out that you, some time ago, about a year ago actually, had a Pentagon source that confirmed to you that something was coming our way, and that that something might arrive in November. Is there any truth to that?
Well, you've got me on the horns of a dilemma. I will tell you, the briefing I did for that three-star general.
It's my job, you know.
Okay, I know. You're very good at this. The briefing I did for this three-star general, who's head of an immensely important operation in the Pentagon, and he's still in power there. If you read that briefing, which I have reproduced in this book, and by the way, people who can't get on the web, they can order it, 888-DR-GREER, D-R-G-R-E-E-R. There's a whole chapter that is that briefing that deals with operational readiness. And at the end of it, I list this possible scenario of an Earth or near-Earth celestial object, asteroid or meteor fragment, impacting the Earth, and the fact that there are technologies not accessible by the legitimate government that could very greatly assist in preventing this, and moreover, that there are covert projects that are apparently targeting extraterrestrial assets from our sources. We've gotten this from multiple sources, and that it may be that this leaves the Earth vulnerable. Because one scenario, which we can't prove or disprove, but it's a possibility, is that the Earth may have a large protective influence from folks from other systems who have been observing our evolution. And if we're targeting them with particle beam weapons and sub-electromagnetic weapon systems, is it possible that it leaves the Earth right in harm's way without any means of an intervention?
Precisely.
So I think that there are many, and this, you know, this is a very serious briefing for a three-star general at the Pentagon, and this issue did come up, and we said, look, there are huge implications to the maintenance of this secrecy and to the fact that there are extraordinary technologies being withheld from the National Military Command Authority, the chain of command that's provided for in our Constitution, and that this is very dangerous. Now, interestingly, this three-star general turned to me and said, you know, I have no doubt that there is a very significant conspiracy. I've peeked into some places and seen evidence of it, but I made directed inquiries into the UFO and extraterrestrial issue and got nothing but either giggles or blanket denials. So much so that someone had actually given him a little E.T. doll that he had on his shelf in the Pentagon. And my military advisors and I, who were at this meeting, were laughing. And we said, where did you get this? He said, someone that I made an inquiry to within the Pentagon and the chain of command gave this to me as a gag gift because they weren't taking my inquiry seriously. Now, this is a three-star general at the Pentagon. And yet he knew that there were things that were kept extremely secret that were even outside of his reach, notwithstanding his extraordinary senior position in a very sensitive post.
Well, so, at the risk of keeping you on the horns of an enema for a moment here, should we be reading between the lines of what you just said?
You should be reading, I think, between the lines of a lot of what I've been saying tonight. Uh-huh. And I can be a little more direct, and that is, there are multiple scenarios, and everything is at play. And I have heard this from people from deep inside what people call the MJ-12 group, the very high-powered group that runs these sort of programs, and that really everything is in a state of free fall. And this is the time for people to collect together and not be timid about telling the truth about what they know.
All right, well, on that score.
And it's very, very important that happen without it becoming something where it's a sort of a, you know, a fear fest.
Okay, well, there was a recent occurrence that I would like your reaction to, and I know that you know about the French report.
Yes.
And apparently a group of highly placed people in France, some retired, some active, put together a report suggesting that there should be a legitimate investigation launched into what was going on in our skies. And it went on to suggest, and I have the English translation, thanks to Whitley Strieber, it suggests that the U.S. attitude about all of this is, in the report, quoted as being strange.
Right.
So what did you think when that French report came out about that sort of group getting together and making that sort of definitive statement?
Well, I think it's a greater, more indication that there are a large gathering of momentum around getting the truth out about this. I just hope that it's not too little too late. I mean, for example, one of the people I'm working with is a very senior National Science Foundation individual who is working on the whole global warming issue and other problems. And the rate of decay of the biosphere and the loss of viability is very profound. And, you know, it's a little bit like, you know, people are fiddling while Rome burns. We have technologies that are locked away in these projects which could totally reinvent the world in a way that does not require any ecosystem damage, even with 6 billion people on it. In fact, I'll go so far as to say that you could probably have, with these technologies, 10 to 15 billion people living on the Earth with a nominal environmental impact for a very, very long time.
Well, then are you suggesting that the people you're talking about would keep these technologies locked in a box while Rome really did finally burn to the ground and while the world came to its knees environmentally?
Well, let me tell you this. There are some very strange bedfellows with these sort of secret operations. You have your militarists, and you have your people who really want to control power for geopolitical and other reasons. And then you have your eschatologists, and these are people who study and study how the world's going to end. And quite frankly, I think you've got a lot of people who may be kind of a screw loose on some of the religious stuff, who may be setting up a self-fulfilling situation.
Absolutely.
Where behaviors are taking place which could result in rather unfortunate, and I'm being understated here, outcomes. And I think that this is one of the things that I did discuss at the Pentagon. And that is not so much, you know, the eschatological, the sort of religious doomsday mindset, which is insane, but the fact that there are consequences to, on a certain timeline, of our not using our collective will to do the right thing. And, you know, I personally believe the Earth is a sort of self-reforming system. And the old adage, you know, the Earth will cast off her burden at a certain point. I don't think that we're going to have the option to just run the biosphere into the ground. You know, a study came out a couple weeks ago that said that by the turn of the next century, 80% or so of all species of life on Earth will be extinct. I mean, you know, this is utter madness, particularly when we know from people that we're working with that the solutions to these problems have already been given to us. And I would say to you that we very much should have had a transition to a non-fossil fuel economy and a totally different way of functioning on this globe about 1950. And it could have been done in 1950, long before I was born.
Oh, yes.
And I think that this is the sad thing is that now we're facing a situation where there has been a lot of dragging of the feet. Now, I have to say that I have some compassion for understanding why that's been done, because this is a very big deal. And I talk about this extensively in this book. There's a whole chapter on understanding UFO secrecy, and in it I go through this analysis of how one thing compounded another to create this culture of secrecy that has woven so many webs that they almost can't extricate themselves. And I think there's a very significant faction of those programs that would like to see a group of civilians come together and disclose it so they don't have to.
I guess I'm asking whether they would take these secrets to our graves.
Well, I think there are some people who do have that perspective. You have to remember, there are people, you know, in policy-making positions like James Watts, who was Ronald Reagan's Interior Secretary, who one time during a conference felt the microphone had been switched off. And he started talking about the fact that, well, we don't need to worry about the environment because the second coming is going to be here soon and the earth is going to be destroyed. It's the end of the world anyway.
I remember.
And this is a man who was, you know, making policy and enforcing regulations for the entire interior of the United States. So, you know, you do worry that you have some of these kinds of people kind of driving this train over a cliff. And I hope that that's not the case.
So do I. Hold on, Doctor. We're at the bottom of the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from September 16th, 1999. Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from September 16, 1999.
I have a fax here from somebody named Tony. I won't give his last name. He's a design engineer, and he says, "Hi, Art. You know, I was present during the Mount Shasta contact event with Dr. Stephen Greer. I'm a real living witness to the event. The first night in the field, I couldn't help but feel skeptical that anything would contact us, we'd have any sort of contact with ETs. But this did not last through the second night. We had the most cosmic and spiritual experience. Dr. Stephen Greer is an honest and very courageous man. It does not cease to amaze me. Would you please request your listeners contribute a meager $10 to CSETI to help in its pursuit of disclosure? Let us wake up to the magnitude of the problem and finally do something."
Now we take you back to the night of September 16th, 1999, on Art Bell, Somewhere in Time.
A couple of things I want to cover with Dr. Greer. Do you recall Tony, by the way, Doctor?
Yes, I do. Yes, he's a very nice man, and he describes himself quite well, very scientifically ordinary, rather skeptical, And when everything started busting loose, I think it was one of the most extraordinary events of his life, and actually of mine. I mean, I have to tell you, the level of experience that happened at Mount Shasta last week was something that, in a group of that size, I don't know if I've ever seen. And the way that the ETs interacted with the group, and the protocols we used were no different than before, except that we, I think, went into there was a degree of synchrony within the group and a degree of commitment there that seemed to get someone's attention, and it was a profound experience for all of us.
Here's a fax from a psychiatrist to you, and it asks the following. Doctor, I frequently treat people with schizophrenia that hear voices and see people and are, of course, they're, of course, not there, so to speak. Has there been any investigation that you're aware of that looks at the possibility of these people perhaps having possible interdimensional doors open for them in their own mind, enabling them to see and hear these other interdimensional beings? Thank you, and I'll be listening. Signed, Dr. So-and-so.
Well, I do think that there are some people who have done that, who are more in the psychological sciences and psychiatry. In my own take on that is that, having taken care of in the emergency department with quite a few people with mental illness and schizophrenia, there's a very profound difference from those people, from people who, say, have had some kind of a spiritual experience or what have you. And it's really not, I don't really see that there's much overlap there at all.
So you don't think there would be residing in a lot of institutions across the country people who...
No. No.
Well,
I think not.
Hear,
I mean, it's sort of a clockwork orange. I really... No, I don't. And in fact, my own take on that is that it's one of the things that can be used to sort of keep people from not talking about these sort of spiritual experiences. And it does take a lot of courage. And I think even UFO sightings, it's hard for people to speak about it because people will jump to the conclusion, well, it's sort of like what Dr. Haynes told me. There was this Japan Airlines event that we have all the documents for, and the pilot was put at a desk because the airline said, these things don't exist, and if you saw them, you've got a problem, shouldn't be flying, until Dr. Haynes went to Japan Airlines and said, this man saw exactly what he said he saw. It was on radar. And so I think we have to be very careful about that. My own take on it is that people who have the genuine extraterrestrial experiences are totally sane and sober, and it's not at all similar to what a schizophrenic might experience.
Well, perhaps not, but to walk into a psychiatrist's office and sit down and suggest that you communicate with beings or take rides on spacecraft or whatever else is probably in the general practitioner's office going to get some quick notes made.
Well, sure, and in fact, there are people who are genuinely mentally ill who make such claims, but it doesn't mean that everyone who has had such an experience is mentally ill. You know, it's like two non-intersecting groups for the most part. I mean, there may be some overlap, but I think very, very little.
I see our ecological problems coming to a head, I think, very much in the way you do. In other words, I don't think that Mother Earth, as one caller said to me recently, gets mad. She doesn't get mad. She gets even. And so it's just a natural course of events. Finally, when the burden shifts the scales too far, there will be an event that will kind of be a reset button.
Right. I think the Earth is a self-healing system that tends towards homeostasis.
Yes.
And you can only do so much to make it in balance before something makes it correct. And this is one of the, you know, this gets into a very spiritual part of the technological issue. And that is, are we abusing technologies and then keeping secret other technologies which could help humanity reach some degree of homeostasis with the Earth rather than destroying it in this sort of cannibalistic way, you know, where we're sort of tearing up our own mother, or the Mother Earth, which has given birth to all of us. And I think that this is really a profound question. And by the way, it's an issue that comes up with a lot of people who've had extraterrestrial experiences, this whole issue of how we're living on the earth and what's being done to the earth. And it's a theme that, that does repeat itself, and I think it's a very valid theme, because if there are life forms from elsewhere, however way you want to define elsewhere, and they're observing that in one person's lifespan that we have damaged the environment to this extent, they would have to be concerned. And I think that there is concern on a very cosmic level. And the Earth, I think, is more important than people can imagine, and that the whole universe is extraordinarily interconnected.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens here is of consequence. It's not like we're just out here on an island unconnected to the rest of the cosmos. And I think that for that reason, during the last half of the 20th century, we have seen this incredible increase in extraterrestrial activity. And I think it is saying something about these issues. Now, my own take on this is that no matter what happens in the short term, I do see homeostasis being returned. I see balance and harmony being returned. And my own feeling about it is that however way that happens, hey, it's out of most of our hands. But if we would all join together to do the right thing and get enough courage to do the right thing,
mm-hmm.
I think we could make a transition much easier. I think it, and I think that this is where the question of free will really comes in. It's kind of what Tony said. If everybody would put a little bit of their effort to their shoulder to this wheel to move disclosure out, to get these technologies out, and et cetera, and so on, it could be done, and it could be done relatively soon.
Yeah,
and
I was going to ask you: is the time frame for that that occurrence? And or the revelation of these abilities that we have, these secrets that are being kept, what's the time frame like? It you know, to us, as we look around at the environmental stories every day, it sure does look short.
Well, we just don't know, and I think this is why we, you know, I take a very Zen approach to this in the sense that I worry about what can I do and what can other people working together accomplish to move things in the right direction. You know, there's this wonderful Chinese saying, unless we change directions, we're likely to end up where we are going. And I think if you look at that and say, well, look, if we're going to make a change, we're going to have to pull together. And you can't be too attached to the outcome. What you really need to do is be saying, what's the right thing for me to be doing? You know, how should I be living? What should I be working on? What's important? You know, sitting and eating Cheetos and watching Jay Leno, or should I be working on these other issues? And then how do I do that? And this is one of the things that I've tried to address, is that there's so many things people can do to help. And I think that if people would actually activate themselves to do something, that the future, being the sort of rubber band that it is, where events can be stretched out or brought closer, the future will be impacted in a very positive way. But it's going to take that collective action for all of us pulling together, much like the people of Denmark during the World War II, when all the stormtroopers came to take the Jews. They all went out in the streets and had yellow stars on their shoulders and said, take all of us.
Mm-hmm.
The whole population of Denmark virtually did this, including their leaders. And you know what? The Nazis backed down, and they didn't take a single Jew from Denmark to Auschwitz or Dachau. Now, this is the power of people working together to accomplish something. And I tell people that they need to view themselves in an empowered way on these issues rather than saying, oh, well, there's Big Brother out there, and it's hopeless. I don't see it that way at all. And I think that it's extraordinary what really can be accomplished. And Tony saw a little piece of it on Mount Shasta. If people will pull together and move things in the right direction, it may take some sacrifice. It may be daunting at times, even dangerous. But so what? You know, I mean, a friend of the president's asked me at one point, well, if the president does what you're asking him to do, we're afraid he'll end up like Jack Kennedy. And I said, so? You know, not that I would wish that on anyone, but for heaven's sakes, there's some things worth sacrificing for.
Do you believe that?
Beg your pardon?
Do you believe that? That if the president moved in the direction you wanted him to, he would end up as Jack Kennedy?
I think everything is how you strategically do it. And I think there are right ways and clumsy ways to do this. So I think everything is determined by the way you do it and what you put into it and how wisely you do things.
Well, as you well know, this president did indeed ask two questions when he came to office. He wanted to know about UFOs, and he wanted to know about Kennedy.
Right.
And I don't believe he got legit answers to either question.
That's correct. He didn't. Not until some others of us got information to him on at least some of these issues. But I do believe that tremendous opportunity exists right now in history to make this change to a totally different way of living on this planet. And it's going to be a bigger change than the Industrial Revolution or the Information Age. And that scares some people. And it people who are very concerned about control and the status quo don't like to hear that. But, you know, we simply can't go on the way we are, and everyone with a thinking brain knows it. And so I think it's time for people of goodwill to pull together and not be so concerned about the risks. I mean, and not that you want to be reckless. I'm not a reckless person at all. Anyone who knows me, I'm very methodical. But at a certain point, you have to say, look, there are certain things worth putting yourself in some harm's way. You know, if we had people who were as self-centered as people living today were, I think we'd all be speaking German now.
Mm.
And I, you know, it's a very big question that each person has to ask themselves, you know, what should I be doing to correct these sort of problems, whether it's excessive secrecy, withholding of technologies, the sort of jingoistic tendency to make it look like there's some sort of an alien invasion when there isn't. All these sort of things are things which people need to stand up and address. And sometimes I feel like I'm a sort of a one-man extraterrestrial anti-defamation league. But but in reality, I think there are many people who have the same sentiment, who do see a long-term future that's going to be sustainable and peaceful. And we are going to become a cosmic civilization and take our place amongst others in the universe. I think that is the future of the human race, and I think we need to begin moving in that direction. And you know what? These things are first created in our consciousness, and if we put that out there, I think we'll see it happen sooner rather than later.
Well, you've obviously demonstrated that contact can be made, that you can actually go out into the field using your protocols, which we never got a chance to talk about.
Well, we'll do that another time, I'm sorry.
And make contact. But again, with regard to intentions, that's an important question.
You bet.
As these things hover above you and maneuver above you, they're not killing you, but on the other hand, they're also not saying, hey, how you doing? So we're kind of left out in the cold.
Necessarily. There's a lot of things that happen where they're very interactive. Both in obvious ways, such as signaling, but also in other ways that are perhaps more subtle. But I think that there is a level of interactivity that we've experienced. And I would say to people that our intent is the only thing we can really worry about. You know, when I was at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, a colonel asked me, gee, do you think they have the ability to be a threat to the national security? I said, well, if they have the ability to turn the planet into a cinder floating through space, if they have the technologies that I'm aware of,
mm-hmm.
I said, it's obvious that's not their intent, or they would have done it by now, for heaven's sake. I think the big question is, what is our intent? What are we doing as humans? This is what we can really control. And I think that we need to be moving in the direction of interfacing with fellow humans and fellow humanoids, if they're of extraterrestrial origin, so be it, that is very much set on a path that is peaceful and interactive in that way. And I've told people that if there, you know, give the, you know, sort of for argument's sake, if there were any extraterrestrial life forms that were hostile, those are the ones that you'd want to have a sort of diplomatic detente or liaison with first. So if you're sincere about these things, you don't really worry too much about the intent of who these visitors are.
All right, well then let's for a second look at our own behavior. If Dr. Greer pulls himself back right now from the world and looks down on this country and the other countries of the world and our behavior and our wars and our bad side and our good side.
Right.
How comfortable are you with the present direction?
I think you're very uncomfortable as we increasingly militarize space, as we allow a secret operation to withhold the technologies which could save the Earth from tremendous damage. I think you'd be very concerned, and I think that's all the more reason why they would be interested in interacting with people who are trying to do the right thing for this planet. I think on the other hand, it also, what they're saying is so that people don't get into this what I call cosmic codependency, where they're sort of saying, oh, you know, someone from space is going to come down here and fix our problems. It ain't going to happen that way. I think they're really expecting us, you know, we're the ones lying to each other about this subject and about the technologies. I really think that they want us to fix it, and they know we have the ability to do it. I know humans have the ability to fix this situation, and I would suggest to people that if we would combine our resources and move in the right direction, it would have been fixed a long time ago. It will take some courage. It will take some wisdom and strategic planning, but it's very doable, and I think that that's really what they're waiting for. You know, Larry King asked me, gee, why don't they land on the White House long? I said, why? You know, I mean, you know, who you know, we're still lying to each other about this. Why should we look to some other outside influence to sort of help push this transition through? I think it's really they're waiting for us to do what they know we have the capacity to do. And the fact that we're sitting around, you know, zoning out on the couch looking at the boob tube, is our own choice. We need to think of other ways that we should be working together to make these changes. And if people had done those things 40 years ago, 30 years ago, 10 years ago, it would have been done.
All right, time
I think
is
we have a great opportunity to do it right now as, at the turn of the century and to start anew and fresh, and I think we should do it.
All right, obviously a lot of people are going to want to read your book, Extraterrestrial Contact, The Evidence and Implications. And there's a missive up on the web now. They can go sort of get a look-see at a little bit of it.
Right, at www.drgreer, or they can just call an 800 number, 888-DR-GREER, and order it.
And order the book.
Yeah, it's not going to be in any bookstores for quite a few months. This is sort of a pre-release we're doing.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, so you cannot get it in any bookstore, Amazon.com, or anywhere. You can only get it on that website or by calling 888 Dr. Greer, D-R-G-R-E-E-R.
And they'll ship it out right away?
Yep.
How much?
I think it's 19-something.
19-something.
Yep. I don't take care of that kind of stuff, but anyway.
I understand. 888-DR-GREER.
Right.
Well,
it's
that's
a toll-free
easy.
Number so they can call it.
You proud of the book?
I think it's a work in progress. Yeah, we really like it, and there are a lot of people who've helped us with it, and in fact, there's a whole section of it Sherry wrote before she died. So, it's a tribute to her. She collected all the best cases in the world and put them together in a section of this book and helped me go through all these 2,000 pages of top secret government documents and put the very best ones in the book. So it's something that you could take sections of it and give it to anyone in the world, whether they're a scientist or a politician, and make a very strong case for the subject just by what's in it. It's a big book. It's about 540 pages, so it's quite large.
Oh, I'm sure a lot of people are going to be going after it after this. Doctor, you're one hell of an interview. You really are.
Well, it's wonderful speaking with you, and I'm glad you've resolved this thing with those. You know, I tell people forgiveness is one of the greatest divine attributes of all, and I was glad to be able to witness that sort of rapprochement happening.
Have a good morning, Doctor.
You too.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
All right, there you have it, Dr. Stephen Greer. And that was one hell of an interview, wasn't it? Well, good night, everybody, and blessed be.